RA-TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Tuesday. No. Let's upgrade that to great Tuesday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, right here on NRA-TV. Hybrid State Park, the Appomattox River, the heart of Virginia. We're just down the road, coming to you from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia. Today, we've got a fantastic show for you all about President Trump's SCOTUS pick last night, Brett Kavanaugh, judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, or the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Steve Holbrook, who's actually argued a case before Judge Kavanaugh, will be with us here in about 20 minutes or so. Carol Markowitz of the New York Post going to join us as well later on in the hour. Stepping away from the coverage of the SCOTUS decision. San Francisco's crisis, she says, looks like New York's future. A lot of poop on the streets, apparently, in the Big Apple. Can we change that to the Big Crapple, Cameron, when that happens, when we get the first 20-pound bag of poop? Can we just change that nickname?
As someone who was born in New York, it's painful to even hear you say that. So I cannot endorse it. I have to stay neutral on this one. Oh, that's so painful.
Okay, fine. Fine. No Big Crapple. How about instead of the I Heart New York, how about the I Poop Emoji New York? How about that?
Okay, because that would be funny on T-shirts. I can see that.
Exactly. Okay. All right, we got you there. Also, coming up in hour two, Charles Cook of National Review talking about Brett Kavanaugh, the pick to replace Anthony Kennedy. In hour three, we'll also check in with Dave Kopel, research director at the Independence Institute, talking about the Kavanaugh pick. And you'll hear from Larry Keene as well, general counsel for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, on the Kavanaugh SCOTUS pick. NSSF coming out with a statement last night praising the president's pick. Laura Carno from Faster Colorado is going to join us in hour two. We'll talk about the Denver Post and then Think Progress picking up on the Denver Post story about Colorado schools arming teachers with no state oversight and few training standards. And they're wringing their hands about this and freaking out about this when they actually could have had state oversight and they could have had statewide training standards. But the gun control activists said no. They rejected a bill that would have done exactly that. And now they're complaining that they don't have that, even though they're the ones who rejected it. Mm-hmm. Talk about it with Laura Carno coming up in hour two. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy as well, coming up at the top of hour three. But right now, let's talk about what happened last night, 9 p.m. Eastern. And it really was amazing. I mean, there was no leakage yesterday. I think it's fair to say that most folks had no clue who President Trump was going to nominate. 9 o'clock Eastern rolls around, and President Trump nominates Brett Kavanaugh, who was on that sort of short list of four names. Judge, as I said, on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, a judge we've talked about, actually talked about his Second Amendment record on Friday's program, because he did hear that case that Steve Holbrook was involved with, the Heller 2 case, challenging D.C.'s semi-auto ban as well as their registration scheme there in Washington, D.C. And Brett Kavanaugh wrote a dissent to the majority opinion because the majority upheld those laws. And we'll talk about the judicial reasoning that those judges used to reach their conclusion. But Judge Kavanaugh reached a very different conclusion. He said, look, if you read Heller and if you read McDonald, the test for us is set out. And under that standard set by Heller and McDonald, these provisions can't stand. You know, Heller specifically, in fact, Brett Kavanaugh said, Heller specifically said that bans on semi-automatic handguns were off the table because they're in common use by lawful Americans for a variety of lawful purposes. So if semi-automatic handguns would be off the table, why would a ban on semi-automatic long guns be acceptable? They, too, are in common use by lawful Americans for a variety of lawful purposes. In fact, they're used in far less crimes than handguns, and the court already told us, well, you can't ban handguns, can't ban an entire class of firearms. So why would we think that we could ban this class of firearms? Doesn't make any sense. Now, NRA's statement last night, Chris Cox, executive director of NRA's Institute for Legislative Action, said President Trump has made another outstanding choice in nominating Brett Kavanaugh for the U.S. Supreme Court. He has an impressive record that demonstrates his strong support for the Second Amendment. We urge the Senate to swiftly confirm Judge Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court, just as it confirmed him to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Judge Kavanaugh has demonstrated his clear belief that the Constitution should be applied as the framers intended, To that end, he has supported the fundamental individual right to self-defense embraced by Justice Scalia in the historic Heller decision. And Chris Cox went on to say, on behalf of our 6 million members, the NRA strongly supports Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. We will be activating our members and tens of millions of supporters throughout the country in support of Judge Kavanaugh. He will protect our right to keep and bear arms and is an outstanding choice to fill Justice Kennedy's seat. Now, over on the other side of the ideological debate here, Brady campaign expresses grave concern over Kavanaugh nomination for Supreme Court. Avery Gardner, the co-president of the Brady campaign, said, "We don't have to guess when it comes to Judge Kavanaugh's track record on gun laws. He's made it quite clear where he stands. And for a president who took more than $30 million from the NRA, Judge Kavanaugh is a perfect fit. This is a judge who sees no difference between, quote, assault weapons and handguns, and who has stated that there is no judicial role when it comes to regulating gun ownership. We call on Judge Kavanaugh to tell the American people clearly and plainly how he interprets the Second Amendment. If he is as hostile to gun laws as he appears to be, then we will fight this nomination tooth and nail." Mm-hmm. So we'll actually get, you know, the funny thing is, and Avery Gardner knows this from the Brady campaign, Brett Kavanaugh actually did talk about what the Second Amendment really means and how he interprets the Second Amendment. Because, again, he wrote that dissenting opinion in Heller 2. So he knows that the Supreme Court in Heller and McDonald stated quite clearly, we're talking about a fundamental individual constitutional right, one that not only federal governments and federal governmental agencies cannot infringe upon, but state or local governments cannot infringe upon those rights either. Crystal clear. Brady VP of litigation, Jonathan Lowy. Judge Kavanaugh must tell the American public whether he will protect their most important right, the right to be safe from gun violence, or whether he will cater to the gun lobby's agenda to let virtually anyone carry any gun anytime, anywhere. At the end of the day, it's a simple question. Do you believe that the right to own guns overrides the right to be safe from being shot? If the answer is yes, you simply aren't fit for a lifetime appointment to America's highest court. So a very substantive criticism there of Judge Kavanaugh, right? This is their vice president of litigation. And he's not citing anything that Judge Kavanaugh wrote in that dissenting opinion. Instead, he sets up this absurd straw man argument. It's a simple question. Do you believe that the right to guns overrides the right to be safe from being shot? Well, here's a question to Jonathan Lowry, the vice president of litigation for the Brady campaign. If a city passes a gun ban, so you can't legally own guns and you still get shot, should you be able to sue that city for violating your rights? Because, you know, it's amazing what's happened in Washington, D.C. after the Heller decision was handed down and the ban on firearms went away. Violent crime dropped. Yeah, it didn't go up in Washington, D.C. Look, it's still higher than the national average. Don't get me wrong. But, for instance, the D.C. gun ban that the Brady campaign loves and apparently, again, really objects to seeing that ban go away. In 1976, the city council passed that gun ban, went into effect in 77. So 10 years on from that gun ban, the homicide rate in Washington, D.C., 27.8 for 100,000 people. Violent crime, 1,426.5 for 100,000 people. I'm sorry, that was in 76 when it was passed. 10 years on, 1986, murders up to 31 homicides per 100,000 people. Violent crime is up to 1,505. Fast forward another 10 years, 1997, the homicide rate in Washington, D.C. is now 57 per 100,000 people, more than 10 times the national average, I believe. Not quite 10 times, but about 8 times the national average at the time in 1997. Violent crime was also up to 2,042 violent crimes per 100,000 people. That, again, is with Washington, D.C.'s gun ban in place. Supposedly the thing that protects our right to be safe, according to Jonathan Lowy. If those gun bans are supposed to protect our right to be safe, they suck at doing that. Now, again, they made it a crime to legally own a gun in your home, but they sure didn't do a thing to stop violent crime in Washington, D.C. 2008, which was the year that the court ruled that D.C.'s gun ban was unconstitutional, homicide rate was 31.5 per 100,000 people. Violent crime, 1,442. Now, we don't have the numbers for 2018 yet, but in 2016, the homicide rate in Washington, D.C., 20.4. The violent crime rate, 1,205, which is lower, you will notice, than any of the figures that I gave you for any year in which the gun ban was in effect. Right. So the gun control groups bitterly clinging to this idea that gun bans somehow protect us. And so they set up this false choice. Well, if you don't support the gun bans, then that must mean that you want people to get shot. No, it actually could be that we just don't think it's effective. That gun owners care just as much about public safety as everybody else does. Try telling that woman in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who protected her coworker, that she doesn't care about public safety. Go make that argument to her. She's carrying a firearm for public safety, for her public safety, and as it turns out, the safety of her coworkers too. But this is what the gun control groups have right now. They've got invective, they've got rhetoric, they've got that false moral high ground. I'm not sure that they've got the votes to stop this, which may be why the rhetoric is so heated. Over at The Guardian, Lois Beckett reports that the Supreme Court pick could make, quote, assault weapon bans unconstitutional. I know, contain yourself. Trump's latest Supreme Court pick, she writes, could be the swing vote needed to tear down some of the remaining restrictions on gun rights in America, including giving citizens a constitutional right to carry a gun in public. Well, again, it's not really giving Americans a right to carry a gun in public. It's more recognizing the right of Americans to bear arms. And again, this is really nothing new. You know, the Heller decision, as well as the McDonald decision, but particularly the Heller decision, because that was the first case that the Supreme Court had, you know, taken that really looked at what it means to both keep and bear arms. And so they defined those terms in Heller, even though Heller wasn't about carrying, it wasn't about bearing arms, it was about keeping arms. The court still defined what it meant to bear arms. Now keep in mind, the right of the people is to both keep and bear arms. And the court has already told us to bear arms means to carry. That's it. It means to carry firearms. So it's not that the court's going to give Americans this right if they do hear a right to carry case. It's that they're going to recognize that we have this right. And it's frankly very telling that, again, the quote-unquote gun safety advocates out there, the ones who claim they're not opposed to the Second Amendment at all, we love the Second Amendment, just in favor of a few common-sense gun safety regulations, doesn't sound like they're really on board with the whole idea of you being able to carry a firearm for self-defense, does it? Because they seem really freaked out about the possibility of the Supreme Court actually acknowledging the plain text of the Second Amendment. Now, we will, over the course of the afternoon, talk a great deal about Judge Kavanaugh, as well as this Heller 2 decision, in which the majority of this three-judge panel, it was a 2-1 decision. You had two judges that basically said, D.C.'s semi-auto ban, it's fine. It's not a, you know, a ban on every rifle. So that's okay, because it's kind of narrowly tailored and there's a public interest, and so that passes muster, particularly under intermediate scrutiny. This doesn't rise to the level of strict scrutiny, doesn't rise to the highest standard of review here. Under intermediate scrutiny, as long as the government can show it's got a compelling interest and it's made some sort of attempt to tailor the law so that it's not as broad as it could be. See, they didn't ban every rifle. They just banned the rifles that they deemed to be quote-unquote assault weapons. So that's okay. That stands. And the registration requirement, yeah, that also, we can just look at that with intermediate scrutiny, and we can find that, yeah, sure, nothing wrong with these registration requirements in Washington, D.C. Judge Kavanaugh took a very different viewpoint. For one, I think he decided not to ignore what the Supreme Court had already said in Heller and in McDonald. And we'll talk about this with Steve Holbrook, who was one of the attorneys involved in Heller 2. After a quick timeout, stick around. We've got much more Cam and Company still to come right after this.
Yesterday, we were actually talking with an individual who's living out of a school bus, and he's driving around the country and specifically hunting on public land because he's trying to raise awareness about, you know, access issues and why public hunting land is so important. Is this a big issue for you as well?
Yeah, I would say it's in the top of the issues. Because, you know, I grew up in Montana, and I've watched over the period of time roads being shut down over and over. And what that does is not everyone has 7 days to go into backcountry and hunting. Not everyone can afford helicopters to lift. A lot of America, you know, works during the week and wants to go out and hunt on the weekend. And if you don't have access, then what it does is it shuts off the legacy of, you know, grandpa going hunting with the kids, or you have military veterans that may be disabled. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing is we've tasked our folks to look at all our range plans, our management plans, and make sure that recreation is a part of it, but also public access. I'm a steward of our public lands. Interior has about a fifth of the territory of the United States falls under Interior. And what we want to do is make sure those public lands are protected in perpetuity. But a lot of it is making sure we rebuild our park system, mm-hmm. and public access to make sure that America should use their public lands. Our public lands belong to the people, not the government. Same thing in the government shutdown. The reason why we kept the parks open, the reason why, because our parks and public land belong to the people and not the government, and that's an important part.
I remember under the Obama administration when we had that government shutdown, I live in central Virginia, and I was driving home from Washington, D.C. I drive through the Wilderness National Battlefield, and there's a little kiosk off on the side of the road. It's never manned. There's nobody ever there, but it's just a little, you know, roadside pull-off. They actually had, you know, sawhorses blocking off the entrance to that little kiosk, so you couldn't even pull in just to read about the battlefield. There was never a staffer there. It wasn't a matter of, you know, well, employees can't be there to make sure that everybody's okay. It really seemed like it was just an egregious middle finger to middle Americans, honestly.
And they weaponized our public lands, parks, and battlefields. The World War II monument, you had the guys coming in that served in World War II all of a sudden don't have access to their memorial. Yeah, in the case of Grand Canyon, you know, they locked the gates, and then there was people that planned their vacation, you know, years in advance. They're knocking on the door, kicking people out of the lodge. So it was egregious. Again, you know, our position is our public lands belong to the public, not the government, certainly not the special interest groups that want to be elitist about access to our public lands. But, you know, it shouldn't be a Republican or Democrat issue. Public lands is red, white, and blue. This is an American issue. And I subscribe to the American conservation ethic. And I tell this story. You know, Roosevelt is widely, you know, known for being a great conservationist and probably set this country on a path where we enjoy today. Teddy Roosevelt goes out to Yosemite. He meets one of our greatest naturalists, John Muir. And John Muir spent a lot of time trying to put flowers in Roosevelt's pocket. But they go on a ride through Yosemite, a ride, by the way, you could not replicate today because there's too much dead and dying timber. Well, Roosevelt comes back and he hires a gentleman named Gifford Pinchot. And Gifford Pinchot really is the father of American conservation ethic of best science, best practices, greatest good, longest term. And I'm an admirer of Roosevelt, but I fall in the Pinchot camp. Let's actively manage our assets so you don't have these catastrophic forest fires. Mm-hmm. Let's look at systems, wildlife corridors. Let's manage our treasures.
Let me ask you this. Hey, welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. Carol Markowitz of the New York Post, coming up a little bit later on in the program, says San Francisco's crisis looks like New York's future. You know, now it should be noted, I'm not really one to talk because we've got poop on our streets here in Farmville, but it's usually horse manure, and it's because we have a growing Amish community. But that's it. That's it. No 20-pound bags of human excrement like they were picking up off the streets in San Francisco. We'll talk about it with Carol Marquis later in the hour. But right now, let's welcome to the program Steve Holbrook, Second Amendment attorney and scholar, is with us. Steve, how are you, sir?
I'm wonderful, Cam. How are you?
I am great. I appreciate you coming on the program. It's so good talking with you today about Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court. And the Heller 2 decision is getting a lot of attention today because this is a case where Judge Kavanaugh was on this three-judge panel that heard a challenge in the Heller 2 case to D.C. semi-auto ban, registration requirements. And you were the attorney on that case, right? I mean, you actually argued this before Judge Kavanaugh.
That's right. You know, after the Supreme Court decided the Heller case, D.C. made it harder and more onerous on gun owners than ever before to get revenge for losing. And they banned a lot of rifles they had not banned before. They called them assault weapons pejoratively, and they made it more difficult to register firearms than ever before. So we litigated that in Heller too. And I found myself in the courtroom with Judge Kavanaugh, Judge Ginsburg, and one other judge, and I argued the case, and I thought we had good arguments in our briefs, but Judge Kavanaugh improved on those arguments. His dissent in that case is really one of the most meaningful Second Amendment opinions that's ever been written by a jurist. First of all, on the basis of how you interpret constitutions, he would rely on text, history, and tradition, and not some kind of balancing test where your rights are always balanced away for the government under intermediate scrutiny. He went through the whole issue of so-called assault weapons, pointing out that the Supreme Court said the common use test is what would be provided. Firearms that are in common use by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes are protected by the Second Amendment, and that applied to all these rifles that D.C. banned. And he also made the point, well, Heller said you can't ban semi-automatic pistols. They're handguns that the court said cannot be banned. How could you possibly justify banning semi-automatic rifles? And then the other part of his dissent was that, for example, requiring registration of all firearms. That's not something that's been part of the history and tradition in the United States. Very few jurisdictions have that. And D.C.'s was the most onerous of any registration system. Hawaii's the only state that had it universally. So he would have invalidated the registration requirements as well. It's a wonderful opinion, and I was just elated to see President Trump nominate Judge Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, and I think he'll make a wonderful justice. And he's also very, very courteous to everybody. He's very judicial. You know, when you argue cases in district courts and appeal courts, you get some judges who are unprepared. They don't ask any questions. They're discourteous. And he was a true gentleman's gentleman. I mean, Judge Kavanaugh was extremely inquisitive and polite to both sides of the argument and complimented us at the conclusion of the arguments.
Let me ask you about something that he uses in this dissent. He talks about this balancing, interest balancing that the majority tried to engage in, and they settled on, you know, intermediate scrutiny was the appropriate avenue to review these laws under a challenge. He says, quote, Heller McDonald didn't just reject interest balancing. The court went much further by expressly rejecting Justice Breyer's intermediate scrutiny approach, disclaiming cost-benefit analysis, and denying the need for empirical inquiry. By doing so, he writes, the court made clear, in my view, that strict and intermediate scrutiny are inappropriate. Now, we talk about strict scrutiny being the sort of, you know, highest standard of review. Judge Kavanaugh says, nah, I don't think it's strict scrutiny or intermediate scrutiny. He says, I think it's the text, history, and tradition. That's what we should be looking at. That's what the court told us to look at in terms of deciding whether or not these gun control laws would be constitutional. Can you talk about what that means, the text, history, and tradition methodology, Steve?
Well, when you look at the Supreme Court's decision in Heller, what do you see? It's an analysis of the text at great length. Keep arms, bear arms, infringement. It's an analysis of the history and tradition, what kinds of regulations existed at the founding? What kinds of regulations existed in the 19th century? For example, concealed weapons. And the court found there is no history and tradition of banning handguns. The court found that certainly it's not justified by the text, the right to keep and bear arms. Handguns are arms. So that was the approach that the majority used in the Supreme Court in Heller. It did not use levels of scrutiny. And in fact, Judge Kavanaugh quotes Chief Justice Roberts in oral argument in the Heller case, where Roberts basically said, you know, these levels of scrutiny, we made this stuff up. This is judge talk. Why don't we just ask, does the handgun ban infringe on Second Amendment rights? And so it was in his dissent, as you pointed out, that Justice Breyer would have used the balancing test. He didn't call it intermediate scrutiny, but he relied on the case law justifying intermediate scrutiny in certain other contexts. And Justice Scalia, in the majority opinion, said, look, it's an enumerated right. That takes certain restrictions off the table, including a ban of this type. We don't do another balancing test. The framers did the balancing already. So certainly there can be restrictions of some kinds geared toward persons who might be dangerous, like convicted felons. But to do it across the board is not justified. And then one other point is, he said, he fell back, though, and said, you know, even if strict scrutiny applied or even if intermediate scrutiny applied, the D.C. ban would the D.C. so-called assault weapon ban would still fail scrutiny.
Yeah, and that is an important point. That was actually going to be my next question. I was going to quote another piece of this dissent here. He said, quote, it's especially inappropriate for the majority opinion here to apply intermediate scrutiny rather than strict scrutiny to D.C.'s ban on semi-automatic rifles. No court of appeals decision since Heller has applied intermediate scrutiny to a ban on a class of arms that have not traditionally been banned and are in common use. A ban on a class of arms is not an incidental regulation. It is equivalent to a ban on a category of speech. Such restrictions on core enumerated constitutional protections are not subjected to mere intermediate scrutiny review. The majority opinion here is in uncharted territory in suggesting that intermediate scrutiny can apply to an outright ban on possession of a class of weapons that have not traditionally been banned there. And they say, whether he said, whether we apply the Heller history and tradition-based approach or strict scrutiny or even intermediate scrutiny, D.C.'s ban on semi-automatic rifles fails to pass constitutional muster. The registration requirement is likewise unconstitutional. And, you know, again, Steve, you and I and folks who follow the segment closely have read a lot of opinions over the last 10 years since the Heller case came out, and we've seen some of these courts of appeals really abuse the Heller decision and abuse McDonald to try to uphold whatever gun control law is being challenged, whether it's a right to carry case, whether it's a semi-auto ban. I mean, we've seen courts of appeals basically acknowledge, yes, you have a right to own these rifles, but that right can be infringed because the government has a compelling state interest and that outweighs your right. They're not really well thought out. They certainly don't cite Heller convincingly. They tend to seize on that quote by Scalia about, you know, nothing in here should negate longstanding prohibitions against, you know, felons or the mentally ill from owning firearms. Conversely, if you read Justice Kavanaugh's opinion, I mean, it's very clear. He studied the case law very clearly. And at one point, he even acknowledges, you know, I might not personally support every one of these challenges. I might personally like a couple of these gun control laws, but I, as a judge, can't approve them if they violate the constitutional rights of Americans. If you want these laws, you're going to have to change the Constitution to allow for these laws.
You can see how these lower courts have stretched things and pushed the envelope. We start out with the Heller 2 case, which was the first one, the first court of appeals to analyze a so-called assault weapon ban. And the court frankly admitted that the rifles that are banned, they're modern sporting rifles. They're in common use by law-abiding people. They are 15. We cited production figures, the numbers manufactured. I mean, the court could not deny and readily conceded that these are in common use by law-abiding people for lawful purposes. So the court got that part right, but then it went on to its balancing test in which you can balance anything away. But what have courts done since then? Like the Colby case by the Fourth Circuit more recently, they don't even admit that the rifles are in common use. They don't even admit that protection of possession of those rifles is within the scope of the Second Amendment. So what we have is we start out with a fairly moderate position by Heller to majority, moderate in the sense that they admit at least some of what the Heller Supreme Court Heller approach was. But even that's eroded. So we're to the point where, like the Seventh Circuit said in that Friendship Heights case, well, even if it makes people feel good to ban these rifles, that's justification enough. And so talk about balancing rights away. But I think what we have here is that Judge Kavanaugh will restore a jurisprudential basis, one consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Heller and consistent with the text of the Constitution, the most important aspect of, to consider, and that he'll make a great addition to the court. And we look forward to Second Amendment litigation going on in the high court. As you know, they haven't taken any new cases on the Second Amendment. We had Heller, we had McDonald, and we had the Catano case, which was a shot out of the dark, a surprise. But other than that, the court's been reluctant to take cases, and we look forward to Judge Kavanaugh joining the bench and righting some of the wrongs. These lower courts are totally out of control. They're involved in massive resistance to the Supreme Court's Heller decision.
Absolutely. Talking again with Steve Hallbrook, Second Amendment attorney and scholar. And Steve, I realize this answer requires you to speculate here, but you know, we don't really know why there was this logjam. We know it takes four judges or four justices to agree to hear a case, takes five to win. And for the past 8 years, as you say, you haven't had four justices on either side. It's not like the four anti-gun justices have agreed to hear these cases, believing that they've got that fifth vote to uphold these gun control laws nationwide. You also haven't had that fourth vote to hear these cases, believing that, okay, that fifth vote for the majority win is there. Do you think that Judge Kavanaugh being confirmed and becoming Justice Kavanaugh, do you think that that breaks up this logjam and breaks up the you know, almost decade now that we've seen the court go without hearing a Second Amendment case?
Well, it would be speculative of me to do that, to make any prediction. And let me say this too. Justice Kennedy, the swing vote on so many issues, we have to give him a lot of credit. Back in the oral argument in Heller, everybody I think might remember, he asked the government lawyer, well, didn't the founders of our country need guns to protect themselves from criminals, Indians, and grizzly bears? And once he said that, we thought, well, he believes in individual rights interpretation. And Justice Kennedy voted with the majority in Heller and in McDonald. So we really don't know on these other issues. Assault weapon bans, right to carry, you know, the right to bear arms not being recognized in the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit and the Third Circuit. We really don't know what the basis of that was in terms of the calculus doing the math and among the nine justices. We would speculate if we said that that would change, but it might well change. And one thing we can be assured of, though, is that Judge Kavanaugh has proven himself in terms of being an extremely deep thinker on these issues. I mean, when you read his the first half of his opinion, it's all about modes of interpretation. It's how we look at the text. We look at what rights are protected explicitly. We don't find ways to balance them away. We don't judicially legislate. Second half of his opinion was on the merits, basically saying that we don't ban guns. And by the way, he reminded the readers that in the Supreme Court, D.C. had argued that you can ban handguns because, well, people can have long guns. And now they're in the Heller 2 case arguing that, well, people can have handguns, and therefore we can ban long guns. And one more point. He showed himself to be very smart and intelligent on a technical basis about firearms. He traced the development of semi-automatic firearms through the early or late 19th and early 20th century. He talked about some of the old Winchester models and showed himself to be very conversant with the historical literature on firearms technology. So that makes him a really well-rounded person in terms of not only Second Amendment interpretation, but understanding actually what implements and arms we're dealing with.
Absolutely. You're right, Steve, because we've seen some abysmal reasoning from judges, I think, who, as you say, they don't get it. They're not gun owners, and that's fine. You don't have to be a gun owner. But if you're going to be ruling on these issues, yeah, you would like to see them delve into the technology, delve into the mechanics. And you're right. That's certainly present in that dissent in Heller, too. Steve, unfortunately, we've got to take a timeout, but I really do appreciate you coming on the program. Thank you so much for the insight, sir, and look forward to talking again very soon.
Glad to be on the show, as always, Cam. Good to see you. Take care.
Good to see you as well. Steve Hallbrook, Second Amendment attorney and scholar. Again, a man arguing before Judge Brett Kavanaugh in the Heller 2 case. And let me quote real quick before we head to break what Steve was talking about here. This is from that Heller 2 dissent by Judge Brett Kavanaugh. He said the majority opinion, the one upholding the semi-auto ban in Washington, D.C., the majority opinion contends that semi-automatic handguns are good enough to meet people's needs for self-defense and that they shouldn't need semi-automatic rifles. And as Steve said, they made the case earlier in the first Heller case, you can have a long gun. You don't need a handgun. So they're really just trying to say, as long as you can have some sort of firearm, we can ban everything else. Judge Kavanaugh wrote, that's a bit like saying books can be banned because people can always read newspapers. That's not a persuasive or a legitimate way to analyze a law that directly infringes an enumerated constitutional right. Indeed, he says, Heller itself specifically rejected this mode of reasoning. Quote, it's no answer to say, as petitioners do, that it is permissible to ban the possession of handguns so long as the possession of other firearms is allowed. Mm-hmm. The judge went on to say, furthermore, the majority's opinion assertion does not sufficiently account for the fact that rifles, but typically not handguns, are used for hunting. In support of its law, D.C. suggests that semi-automatic rifles are offensive and not just defensive. But that is plainly true, he writes, of semi-automatic handguns as well. And yet the Supreme Court held that semi-automatic handguns are constitutionally protected. Moreover, he says, it's hard to see why, if a gun is effective for offense, it might not also be effective for defense. He's able to cite Heller, but he's also able to think through this, right? So he's relying on precedent, but he's also not afraid to actually explore this argument that the District of Columbia presented. Okay, well, what are the flaws here? Let's think this through. If this is your argument, how does this work? And again, came to the conclusion that D.C.'s semi-auto ban, the registration requirements, are infringements on your right to keep and bear arms. We'll talk more about this throughout the afternoon. We've got to take a quick break, though. When we come back, Carol Markowitz at the New York Post, San Francisco's crisis. She says, looks like New York's impending failure. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Everyone understands the importance of securing our public places. That's why every major corporate campus and office tower, every sporting event, celebrity award show, and government building, all of it, is protected by multiple layers of security. But when it comes to our most precious resource, not gold or oil or precious jewels, our children, we utterly fail to protect them at school every single day. Each day that goes by, our banks and businesses are better protected than our children. That's a national outrage. NRA's School Shield program has already made world-class security resources available to hundreds of American schools. It's free of politics, and it's free of charge. If your child's school isn't protected, ask them to call School Shield today. We're the National Rifle Association of America, guardians of our school children and freedom's safest place.
We are talking with the authors of the brand new book, The Great Revolt, Selina Zito, Brad Todd. And Brad, I'll start with you. Give us the subtitle, because I got The Great Revolt, but every good book needs a really long subtitle as well. So what's The Great Revolt, :
Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics.
There you
go. And I imagine that there are a lot of members of that populist coalition here today in Dallas.
I'd say that maybe 100% of this building is inside that coalition. We even have a chapter in the book. It's a look inside the Trump coalition and not just how it changed the election in 2016, but try to spark the conversation what else is going to change in American commerce and American society. One of our chapters in the book is what we call Girl Gun Power. We examine sort of seven types of the Trump voter, and Girl Gun Power is a group of women who voted only on the Second Amendment or made that the dominant issue in their vote, which that's a thing a lot of the mainstream press completely ignored, wouldn't understand it if they did know about it. So hopefully this book will bring that to light.
Yeah, in particular, suburban, college-educated women. I think that they totally missed their understanding of the empowerment that it gives you as a woman. It's the ultimate feminist thing to do, to be able to protect yourself.
Well, they do miss it, because what we hear is that any woman who owns a gun is doing so not because of empowerment, but because of fear. They're being, you know, pressured by their husbands, or they're being, you know, lectured by someone like Dana Lash. But they're never able to actually make that conclusion on their own that I want to be a gun owner. It's so amazing. And you know, it's become a common trope now of this is how you got Trump. Well, this is how you get President Donald Trump, and this is how you get the Great Revolt, when you refuse to take your fellow Americans seriously,
right,
for exercising, you know, their right of self-defense. That, I mean, if you're going to shame somebody for making that decision, you're not taking them seriously.
Well, one of the most important things, and Brad, you can elaborate on this because you're way smarter than me, but one of the most important things, I think, about the book is that we're in the middle of this movement and nobody's hearing what it's telling us, that there are so many variables into why these voters came together. You know, Trump was not the cause of this. He was the result of it. And it hasn't stopped. It's continued. And I would argue, maybe I'm wrong, that it's getting stronger as opposed to sort of losing its high winds.
Well, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? And the what's happened on the cultural left, and I think with sort of brand decision makers, in, you know, they all live in L.A. or Seattle or San Francisco or New York, that's very far removed from sort of this populist conservative coalition. And so I think you're seeing that they're making brand decisions that reflect the bubble they're in, and not their customer base. And I think you're going to see more and more customers say, and we're not going to put up with that.
I hope so. You know, so let's talk about who makes up this coalition, because, again, if you listen to those folks in L.A. or D.C. or New York, flyover country, you know, Hillary Clinton made this comment about, well, the progressive parts of the country, the forward-thinking parts of the country, right, they voted for me. But those backwards places, those little burgs and hollows around the country, you know, where the gap-toothed rednecks live, now is the places that voted for Trump. Who makes up this populist coalition?
Well, they're optimists, first off. That's one thing I think that our book brings out that you don't see in coverage of the Trump coalition much. You know, Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again, is an optimistic, forward-looking slogan. Her slogan, I think, was Better Together, which is a statement of the present tense, not the future. And our we did a survey of Trump voters in the five states in the Midwest. It's all in the book. All these details are in the book. And they believe, they're very optimistic about their own personal career choices, their own personal financial situation, even if they're worried to death about their community's financial health and economic health. I think that's something the press also missed. You know, if you read most news accounts of Trump voters, you'd think that they were, you know, angry and strung out on heroin and, you know, unemployed. And, you know, that's the way that the New York Times or the Washington Post wants you to see the typical Trump voter as. We found that they were, and we were on the ground in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and in Macomb County, Michigan, and Keokuk, Iowa, all in sort of these places in the middle of the country, very optimistic people. They just want their country to be fixed.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. More. Danny had some fun with the drone yesterday out at Hybrid State Park, just outside of beautiful Farmville, Virginia. It's a great state park. If you love biking, if you like hiking, it's an old railroad track, and it runs right over the Appomattox River, very high up. If you're not a fan of heights, might want to just stay off of the High Bridge part of Hybrid State Park. Other than that, though, absolutely fantastic. Carol Markowitz of the New York Post is with us on the program at Carol with a K on Twitter. Carol, how are you today?
Hey, Cam. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. I read your piece of the New York Post, and look, I have to admit, I acknowledged this earlier. If we're talking about, you know, poop on the streets, Farmville has It's share sometimes. It's usually horse manure. We have a growing Amish community here, and they bring their carriages through town.
Right.
So I'm not one to throw stones or hurl poop or whatever. But you know that out in San Francisco, this major medical association yanked its convention from San Francisco because the attendees said they don't feel safe there in San Francisco. And you say New York could be next.
Right, and that's a big problem. You know, I'm a lifelong New Yorker. I'm a city girl. I feel safe in cities, and I felt unsafe when I visited San Francisco. It is just so overrun with homeless people and drug addicts that it was really an issue. Like, you see needles in the street. You see tracks on people's arms as they're walking around. It is an epidemic over there. And I can easily see it happening in New York as well, because we're following their policies where they've decided not to prosecute quality of life crimes like peeing in the street or using drugs in public or other such crimes. And we're following their lead on that. And it seems baffling to me that we would return to the policies which have failed cities for so long. But here we are, and we're saying that that's the more compassionate route. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether the residents of New York City will accept that kind of, quote, compassion.
Yeah, I mean, you write about the some of the Band-Aid solutions that New York City has applied. $500,000 a day the city spends right now. $500,000 a day they spend on putting homeless individuals in hotel rooms.
Yeah. I mean, you can build more housing for that amount of money. $500,000 a day is such a staggering amount. And yet here we are spending it every single day on hotel rooms for homeless people because we can't figure out any permanent solutions. And there's just so many issues with that, you know, that we're just like papering over the problem and hoping it'll somehow go away. One of the pushbacks that I've gotten about this piece is, well, San Francisco has better weather than New York, so New York will never have the homeless problem that San Francisco has. But the fact is, New York does have more homeless people than San Francisco. Its policies actually do matter, because if you don't have policies that actually help the homeless, actually get them into permanent homes, you're going to have the situation like San Francisco, where, you know, the street life has become so unbearable that your conventions are saying we can't come here.
Yeah. I mean, and you say that, okay, so August 1st, de Blasio has told police stop arresting people for smoking pot in public. Now, smoke a cigarette, Carol.
Yeah.
And you're right? Sell a Lucy, and that's still plenty of trouble, but you want to light up a doobie, that's fine. And the city plans to open up 4 safe injection sites for heroin users to shoot up under the supervision of medical professionals.
Right. And I'm libertarian-y on drug use.
Right.
I think whatever people do in the privacy of their own home is, you know, one thing. I don't know if we should be arresting pot smokers, but certainly giving a ticket or some other sort of citation. And I think they're just going to do away with it completely. And I really believe in the slippery slope of, if you're allowing drug use in public, you're going to have other drug use. You go to Amsterdam, where smoking marijuana is legal in cafes. It has spilled out into the streets. In Amsterdam, you could see plenty of other drug use happening. It is just, it's almost inevitable. Same thing, from what I understand, in Colorado, ever since they have legalized marijuana, it becomes a culture where unless you crack down on public drug use, you're going to have this slippery slope.
You know, we talk a lot about the opioid epidemic on this program, and I think, like, Vancouver, British Columbia was the city that really kind of pioneered the safe injection sites, at least within the last few years. And, you know, the thing is, Carol, like, the number of overdose deaths continues to rise dramatically in British Columbia. There's no evidence that having these safe injection sites actually stops people from overdosing. I guess, again, if you're shooting up under the supervision of a doctor, maybe you don't. But the number of people who are dying continues to increase there in the province of British Columbia.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I remember visiting New York in the early 90s before Times Square got revitalized, and it was still seedy, and it was, you know, a semi-dangerous place. I remember my stepmother telling me that I could not wear my jacket. I had a leather jacket that I brought with me from Oklahoma, and she said, no, you can't go out. So she gave me her son's, like, cloth jacket with the Kiss Army patches. So, you know, she's like, you're not going to get mugged that way. I said, okay. So, I mean, I remember those days, and then I remember the Disneyfication of Times Square and, right. you know, the gentrification of New York. As somebody who's lived in that city, as you say, most of your life, do you see, can you see the city going back? Can you see it changing?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because so with the safe injection sites, drug addicts are not known for making great decisions. And so the idea that they're going to travel to one or two or three of these injection sites, I guess by subway, they're going to be spending their money on the subway instead of on drugs. And they're going to be going to these injection sites to make the right decision of getting a safe injection. It's just like, really, you have to know nothing about drug users to think that this is a solution. And I think that that's just another, again, Band-Aid solution to a drug problem, Band-Aid solution to the homeless problem. We can't keep solving these problems with these temporary measures. And these temporary measures generally don't work anyway.
So what is the mood there in New York? I mean, you write that New York, like San Francisco, very much a one-party town.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so is there a growing sense of unease among residents in New York, or is it that Carol, you're crazy? Right. This is all going to work out. We just haven't put the Ocasio-Cortez right. de Blasio plan fully in place yet. Yeah. And when real right. socialism arrives, Carol, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah. Well, look, de Blasio's been mayor for 5 years now, and he has a Democratic city council, and anything he wants to pass, he can pretty much pass. I mean, again, we're spending $500,000 on hotel rooms because he can do whatever he wants pretty much. So the idea that, we just haven't been able to do it yet because we don't have enough leftism is just silly, and in New York it's just not true. I think, there was a post, there's a group called Park Slope Parents, which, as you can imagine, Park Slope is a very, very liberal enclave in New York, and as you can imagine, there's some really funny posts on there. But there was a family who was like, there's a homeless man who started living on our stoop, like, what should we do? Our landlord says, well, he just lives, that's where he lives, so what are we going to do? So I feel like people want to take action, or they want to see action taken, but their liberalism just prevents them from really saying what they mean, and it ends up with these ridiculous situations where your landlord can tell you, well, listen, the homeless guy just lives on our stoop. What are we going to do?
Talking again with Carol Markowitz from the New York Post. Her latest, San Francisco's crisis looks like New York's future. Carol, listen, unfortunately, we are almost out of time. But
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always a pleasure. One last question for you. I mean, are you bearish or bullish on New York's future right now?
It's tough because I trust New Yorkers that if things get bad enough, they're going to revolt. And look, they voted for Rudy Giuliani twice. They voted for Mike Bloomberg, which they saw as his replacement, three times. And so, I think New Yorkers won't let it get too bad, but it's concerning. It's definitely concerning that for now we're following San Francisco down its, as I said, poop filled road. So.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate your time today, Carol. Look forward to doing this again
very
soon.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Carol Markowitz with the New York Post, again on Twitter, at Carol with a K, parkslopeparents.com. You have to register, though, Cameron, to actually get into, like, the message boards, unfortunately. And I don't.
Yeah, you don't want to read those.
To have the attention span to do that. No, I did see. Now, this has already passed, but join Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams for a stroller march Saturday, June 24th, in opposition to ICE. Families belong together, brooklyn-usa.org. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So
great.
There you go. All right. Now, coming up next hour, Laura Carno joins us from Faster, Colorado. We'll talk about the piece of the Denver Post picked up by Think Progress. And I guarantee you Think Progress, the person who picked this up and basically rewrote the New York or the Denver Post story, no idea of the legislative fight that went on in Colorado last year. And so it's all about trying to scare the anti-gunners out there. Oh, my God, Colorado schools are arming teachers, and there's little state oversight, and there's no training standards. Can you believe this is happening? But the truth is, there could have been state oversight. There could have been statewide training standards. There could have been all of those things. And matter of fact, Laura Carno was one of those who was advocating for all of those things. Because there was legislation last year in Colorado that would have set up, basically like Texas has, a guardian program. So there would have been state standards. There would have been a state oversight. And this is something that gun owners and supporters of this legislation told lawmakers in Colorado, hey, right now, school districts can still do this. They can still declare that they want this staff member or that staff member to be armed security. You can't stop them. But this would actually allow for the process to be a little bit more streamlined, would allow for those standards to be developed. And anti-gun lawmakers said no. It was the gun control advocates. It was the people who read Think Progress who said no. And now they're the ones complaining. So we'll talk about that with Laura Carno next hour. Charles Cook of National Review on Brett Kavanaugh being named to replace Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. Over at National Review, Ed Whalen, back on Independence Day, had a piece that took a look at Judge Kavanaugh's dissent in the Heller 2 case. And we'll get into that as well next hour. A lot more discussion about the Supreme Court pick. And honestly, today's the day. Start calling now. You know, we talk about this being a fait accompli. Look, we've told you what the gun control groups are saying. They don't want this vote. They don't want this confirmation. They're going to do everything they can to try to stop it. So your senators need to be hearing from you. Hour 2 of Cam and Company comes up next.
Our friend Julie Golub from Team Smith & Wesson, not only now a competitive shooter, but a published author as well here. Toys, Tools, Guns, and Rules.
Yes.
This is fantastic.
It's exciting. It's so exciting to, you know, help us communicate our important message of firearm safety in yet another way.
Yep. Can I show
Absolutely.
The book?
Absolutely.
There we go. How we sell some books on this program. Got to let people see the cover. What made you decide that this was something that you wanted to branch out and do?
So a lot of the information out there is absolutely critical and important. Of course, we've got NRA Equal Gun Safe Program, and it teaches that universal message that we have to avoidance, stop, don't touch, go get an adult. But I was looking for something that was a little bit more in depth for my daughters. Mm-hmm. I'm a mom, I'm a shooter, so I wanted to go somewhere where that they felt a little bit more comfortable. And I also wanted to, you know, dive in a little bit, you know, kids.
Oh, yeah.
If there's a button, they want to push it. If there's a dial, they want to turn it. So I delve into the anatomy of a firearm, explore the different types, and also the fact that, you know, there are gun owners everywhere. It's not just law enforcement and military. It's not just competition shooters.
Right.
We have hunters, and we also have everyday CCW holders that all around. So I wanted to normalize it and give parents yet another option so that they can talk to their kids, because everybody has a different relation point.
Right.
And the more messaging we can get out there, the better.
Yeah, I'm completely in agree with you there. We don't have anything close to a monoculture anymore. So,
no.
You know, as wide as the reach of Eddie Eagle is, I mean, you know, a million kids a year almost.
It's incredible.
But they're still not reaching every kid and every family that could be reached, right? So I'm with you. There's no such thing as too much education.
No, exactly.
And too many opportunities to learn about these things. Now, how old are your daughters?
9 and 4.
Wow.
Yeah, it's such a neat moment because my 9-year-old can read to my 4-year-old, and they can have that magical moment. In fact, my 9-year-old shoots with me now, so there's this whole process that they're bringing. And I tell you what, when you have that moment when your daughter is reading to your daughter and she knows about firearm safety and the fact that she can communicate that, that's such a critical thing for us as gun owners to be able to do. And when we have our kids being able to teach their siblings.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when the magic really happens.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting because as a parent, you know, you want to introduce your kids, as you say, to the shooting sports. And obviously something like this, you know, even before you're taking your daughter out shooting, this is a great introduction. But, you know, it's interesting because I've got 5 kids and they're all different.
They are.
And so, you know, I feel bad sometimes because, like, I've got, my youngest are twins.
Yes.
They're going to be 13.
Oh my
next
word.
Month, Julie. I know. But my daughter was ready to shoot before my son was.
Yeah.
And as a parent, I'm like, you know, I feel kind of weird about that. But you know what? You're not ready. You're not emotionally mature enough. It doesn't mean that you're not ever going to be, but just now. No, and is that hard for you sometimes? Like, you know, and do you run into other parents who talk about this? Like, how do I make sure that I'm treating my kids fairly, but I'm also, you know, being a responsible gun owner and a responsible parent when it comes to teaching your kids how to shoot?
Absolutely. I think the greatest challenge is, you know, we want them in it. We want them so much to enjoy what we enjoy and feel the importance and learn the importance of the Second Amendment. But it has to be at a pace that they're comfortable with and their maturity level. That's the key thing. A lot of people ask me, hey, when should I take my children to the range for the first time to shoot? And I always say, do they know firearm safety rules? Can they follow your rules at home first? And then you can take them to the range, because there are range rules, there are firearm safety rules. It's a very specific thing, and that's one of the reasons why the title of the book is Toys, Tools, Guns, and Rules. Mm-hmm. And we establish these rules, and it's very important. But if your child, I don't care if you're 2 or 92, if you don't understand the importance of following rules and safety rules, then maybe the range isn't for you right now.
Yeah.
That's the next step. So,
yeah. This isn't, it's not playtime. It's fun.
It is.
But it's not playtime.
It is not.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. Cam Edwards, your host, Laura Carno of Faster Colorado, joining us on the program, Charles Cook of National Review. Later in the hour on the Kavanaugh SCOTUS pick, about an hour from now, today's Hero of the Day, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day. Talked about the Brady campaign, talked about Every Town for Gun Safety and their reaction to the pick of Brett Kavanaugh. Now, Shannon Watts on Twitter... I looked on the Moms Demand Action website, by the way. I can't find anything, but Shannon Watts tweeted out, Judge Kavanaugh's made clear he would strike down prohibitions on the AR-15 and other assault-style weapons. In 2011, he dissented from a decision upholding Washington, D.C.'s prohibition on assault-style weapons and its requirement to register handguns. And then one of her supporters, Merrill, maybe he'll meet his maker as a victim of such a weapon. A girl can dream. Such unhinged rhetoric there from the gun control crowd. But, that's and, you know, I will say that, unfortunately, not the only really over-the-top wishing ill or harm even to this candidate that we saw on display last night. In fact, Shannon Bream at Fox said that they actually had to pull out of doing the show from in front of the Supreme Court because she felt threatened. She felt like there was an ugly energy there. Lindsay Feifeld, who I follow on Twitter, works in D.C., had said that she was out there as well. And she said, you know, this is a woman who works in D.C. And she said, I've been around protests before. I'm used to those things. She said, I have never felt as uncomfortable as I did last night. And I wasn't counter-protesting. I wasn't carrying a sign. She said, I was smiling. And the reaction that she got, the ugliness on display there from those who frankly, by the way, showed up with Stop Kavanaugh signs, Stop Ketledge signs, Stop Barrett signs, Stop Hardeman signs. I mean, they didn't know who the pick was going to be, so they planned ahead, and they printed out all those signs. What do you think happens to those signs, Karen? Is it like when the loser of the Super Bowl, they get their Super Bowl champion T-shirt right. Sent to like developing countries.
Yeah.
Are there going to be people who are now thinking that, you know, Hardeman has been the nominee
right.
And he's going to get nominated?
Well, we were talking yesterday, you know, about the fact, you know, you were asking, you think there'll be protesters out there? And honestly, I knew I thought there would be, but I didn't expect to be that many. It was a lot of protesters.
About 300 or so.
It looked like a big scene on TV. Because the other thing, too, is, and you did that speech in front of the Supreme Court, in front of the Capitol, across the street from the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court, the front of it, doesn't have it's not a huge footprint. It's one of the smaller buildings, I think, in Washington. So it doesn't take a lot of people to look like a very crowded scene. But the thing that I was really struck by was... As I mentioned yesterday, I went home and turned it on immediately, and I watched it, and I had it on CNN leading up to it. And in one window, they showed, you know, the panels or whatever. And then the other one was, this was before the pick, this was about 8:45 p.m. Eastern time, and they were showing the protesters getting ready, and there was a ton of NARAL, keep abortion legal signs, those types. But then they were live when the anti-abortion activists started walking through. They had their stop abortion now. You know, you've seen these signs a million times. And as soon as they started to walk by them, the woman with the bullhorn with the pro-abortion groups, they were like trying to block them out. like it was a basketball game. They were really pushing as hard as you can go, you know, without the cops needing to get involved. And the, you know, the abortion rights people had their signs trying to cover up the anti-abortion signs. And they were just trying to get to a place where they could demonstrate too. And it's a small microcosm, I know, but it's what we see over and over again. The left doesn't like dissent, and they weren't there to start a fight. They just, you know, they wanted to put their point of view out there and be like anyone else who was protesting from the Supreme Court. But the pro-abortion side wasn't having it. It was kind of uncomfortable to watch at points, and I'm sure it got worse after the pick. This was just beforehand.
Liz, I'm sure it got worse too. But again, this comes down to, and this has nothing to do with. This has nothing to do with jurisprudence. This has nothing to do with respect for the Constitution. This has nothing to do with the First Amendment. It doesn't. Because to those folks, it's just, I disagree with what they're saying. And what they're saying bothers me so much that I consider it to be hate speech. Right? So they're not even thinking about it in terms of a First Amendment free speech issue. They're just thinking about, I don't like what they're saying, so I'm going to try to stop them from saying it. Now, this is one of the reasons why we have our constitutional rights. Is because, you know, look, left to our own devices, there are going to be plenty of human beings out there that will say, I don't like what you say, so I will shut you up. Right? You can't protect yourself, so I will victimize you. We have these individual rights because, as Madison wrote, we know that men are not angels. And frankly, that applies to those individuals in government as well. That's why we have laws. That's why we have a framework of government. So we all know what the rules are. Now, when you decide you don't want to play by the rules anymore, and you're going to invent them as you go along, you can only do that so long as, A, the law allows you, and B, society allows you to do that. And in Washington, D.C., unfortunately, society says, yeah, that's fine. The culture of Washington, D.C. is such, it's so deeply blue that it is fine to yell at people you disagree with and restaurants, as long as the disagreement is over something, you know, look, if there's somebody that's in the minority in terms of their ideological opinion in Washington, D.C., yell at them. You can't yell at somebody in the majority, but you can yell at somebody who has a minority point of view in Washington, D.C. You can try to shut them up. Let's see, we're just getting this out of Wired sources here. Moderate GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins signal support for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, with Collins telling reporters that Kavanaugh is, quote, clearly qualified for the job. Okay, now that would be big. Because here's the thing. Senator Chuck Schumer last night said, I'm going to oppose this with all that I have. And as I said on Twitter, you have nothing. And Chuck Schumer by himself has nothing. He has 49 Democratic senators. So the hope for Democrats to try to stop this, the Hail Mary, well, okay, shouldn't use a religious term, Cameron, because the dogma is strong in the Hail Mary. So let's come up with another term here. the last ditch effort to try to block Brett Kavanaugh goes something like this. Democrats can peel away Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. So now, rather than at 51 Republicans, they're at 49. Now Mitch McConnell has to get a red state Democrat to cross over. Joe Manchin, Donnelly in Indiana, Heitkamp, they all voted for Gorsuch. Or maybe John Tester, or maybe Claire McCaskill, also red state Democrats who are up for re-election this year. They did not vote for Gorsuch. So Schumer's hoping they can peel a couple of Republicans away and keep the entire Democratic caucus intact. And then lo and behold, there aren't enough votes to get Brett Kavanaugh confirmed. It fails. Now, again, you want to game this out. And there was some polling that was released today showing that voters in these states that I just mentioned, Montana, Missouri, West Virginia, North Dakota, Indiana, voters in those states by wide margins want to see a confirmation vote held before the midterm elections. And they want to see Justice Kavanaugh confirmed. So if you're a red state Democrat and Chuck Schumer is leaning on you, twisting your arm so that you remain in the caucus and you don't cross over and vote for this guy, you're going to face the wrath of the voters in November. And it may very well be that you don't get to come back to Washington And then there's not a 51-49 Republican majority in the Senate. Maybe it's a 53, maybe it's a 54, maybe it's a 55-seat majority for Republicans. That's the pickle that Chuck Schumer finds himself. And if Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski say, yeah, we're on board with Brett Kavanaugh, okay, well, now you're at 51. Schumer at that point would probably be inclined to let those Democrats go and go ahead and vote for them. And that way that's not something else that you can get dinged on. I did see a quote, Patrick Morrisey, who's the Republican Attorney General of West Virginia, who's running for Senate against Joe Manchin, said earlier today that he believes that Joe Manchin will vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh because, as he put it, quote, his political life depends on it. So that's the Republican candidate who's challenging Joe Manchin in West Virginia, who says, yeah, I think the Democrat is going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh because if he doesn't, he's guaranteed to be toast in November. So the political calculations are certainly at work. Again, I would encourage you, no matter where you live, your senator should be hearing from you on this issue. But particularly if you are in Alaska, Maine, Missouri, Montana, West Virginia, Indiana, North Dakota, if you're in one of those states, your senators absolutely need to be hearing from you. And you're going to get sick of television and radio here in the next few weeks because every time you turn it on, you're going to be hearing an ad telling you to either support Judge Kavanaugh or to oppose Judge Kavanaugh, and it's I'm telling you, it's going to get tiresome. You're going to want to tune it out, but keep the pressure on. Keep the contacts going with your senators because it really is. Look, this is I'll give you an example of why this is so important. This is The Guardian, left-leaning newspaper, anti-gun. And a piece today, Supreme Court pick could make assault weapons ban unconstitutional. Yeah. That's what's at stake. It's been 10 years since we've heard the Heller decision come down. It's been 8 years since the McDonald decision came down. And as Larry Keene said last year, since then, the only time that the court has really said anything at all about the Second Amendment was about 6 weeks after Antonin Scalia passed away. And in a unanimous guidance to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, the Supreme Court of the United States told those judges, hey, this case dealing with a stun gun ban, you got to go back and take another look at this because your reasoning's way off here. We said in Heller that just because an arm wasn't around in 1791, that doesn't mean it's not protected by the Second Amendment, which is the conclusion that y'all read. So you're wrong there. And you got to go back and take a look at the facts of this case. They basically said stun guns are protected by the Second Amendment. Since then, we've seen some stun gun bans fall, and Maryland, Massachusetts finally got rid of theirs. New Jersey got rid of theirs. There are only a handful of states that had these bans in place to begin with. But that was the last time the court said anything about our right to keep and bear arms. Now, Dave Koppel talked with, and he's going to join us coming up in hour three. He talked with Lois Becker of The Guardian, and he noted, he said it's unclear if this nomination of Brett Kavanaugh would give the Second Amendment advocates the votes that they need in the Supreme Court. As Beckett writes, while some conservative justices have publicly criticized the court's recent choices not to take on Second Amendment cases, it's not clear if Chief Justice John Roberts is a strong gun rights supporter or if he might be a, quote, moderating force. And I kind of alluded to this when we were talking with Steve Holbrook yesterday or earlier in the program. We know it takes four justices to hear a case, and we know it takes five to win. We know that we haven't had four justices agree to hear a case since McDonald back in 2010. What we don't know is why, and frankly, we don't know who. Now, we do know that Justice Scalia, before he passed away, he signed on to a dissent urging the court to hear a case. We know that Justice Thomas wrote that dissent in Friedman versus Highland Park. So we know that Justice Thomas wants the court to hear a case. We know that Justice Gorsuch has actually signed on to a dissent urging the court to hear other cases. I'm not sure if Sam Alito has actually signed on to a formal dissent or not. So again, we don't really know exactly why the court hasn't heard a case. And this has been one of those theories, right? Well, was it Kennedy? And was Kennedy the question mark? Because he was the swing vote. And so maybe you had the four justices who voted to hear Heller and McDonald, But maybe they held off because they didn't know how Anthony Kennedy was going to vote on a right to carry case. They didn't know how Anthony Kennedy was going to vote on a case like the Colby case out of Maryland, dealing with the bans on semi-automatic firearms, or Heller 2. And on the other side, if you've got four justices on the court who are opposed to your right to keep and bear arms, who think that Heller was wrongly decided, who would support basically any gun control law that comes before them, okay, well, why haven't they voted to hear a case? Because they don't know what that fifth vote would do, right? So under that theory, and again, that's all this is, a theory. It's just speculation. We've got no facts. I'm not presenting this as a fact. I'm not presenting this as exclusive information that I heard third hand from an anonymous source that I can't tell you about. I'm not NBC News, okay? I'm telling you up front. This is pure speculation. But under that theory, okay, well, if Kennedy's not on the bench anymore, if he's retired and then he's replaced by Judge Kavanaugh, then maybe now you've got not just four votes, but maybe now you got five votes to hear a case, and maybe you've got that fifth vote in the majority. The other theory is that, well, maybe it wasn't Kennedy that was the question mark. Maybe it's Chief Justice John Roberts that's the question mark. And again, we have no evidence for this, one way or the other, because the Supreme Court doesn't really leak. So we don't know what happens in these conferences when the judges are considering these cases. We don't know. But we do know this. Unquestionably, the confirmation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court gets us closer to a day where the court will not only start hearing these cases again, but again, they will start ruling on these cases with a clear understanding and a clear reading of the Second Amendment and the protections that it provides to the pre-existing right to keep and bear arms that Americans possess. You can take that to the bank. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout, Laura Carno from Faster Colorado. Later in the hour, more on the Kavanaugh SCOTUS nomination. Charles Cook of National Review will be with us on the show. We'll be back right after this, so stick around.
Let me ask you a simple question. Do you believe you have a right to defend yourself and your family with a firearm in your own home? Four Supreme Court justices say you do, but four say you don't, because the deciding vote announced he's retiring. And your most fundamental right to self-defense could be extinguished. This is our opportunity to protect the one freedom that guarantees all the others. The freedom that makes America different from every other country on earth. The Second Amendment is at stake. America is at stake. We are the last place on earth that still believes in the fundamental God-given right of self-defense. And we don't care if we're the last ones in the arena. We will never, ever stop fighting for this freedom. We're the National Rifle Association of America, and we're freedom's safest place.
From the National Diversity Coalition for Trump, obviously, you know Kaya from her music, and Kaya, it's good talking to you today.
Yes, hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Is this your first SHOT Show?
This is my first SHOT Show.
Okay, so what do you think so far?
I'm really excited. I feel like there's like warrior gear, and you know, and I want to be a ninja, so this is up my alley.
I think there's actually like a ninja seminar coming up in about an hour and a half.
Yay.
Yeah, so you can find out. I've got to ask, man, what brings you to SHOT Show this year?
Just to meet everyone and to really understand everything better, the weapons better, especially because I became a member last year of the NRA. I'm very excited about that.
Nice.
And, yeah, I was announced as the number one celebrity pro-Second Amendment on LifeSet. So for me, it's really about understanding and empowering girls, empowering women, to, especially with Me Too. You know, when the Me Too thing came out and all of the women are marching, I don't believe that marches get us anywhere. We need empower. So,
let's talk about that if we can for a second.
Yeah.
I'm a father of two daughters. Mm-hmm. I have been married to a wonderful woman for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I love strong, independent women. But you're right, empowering women mm-hmm. to be able to protect themselves so they don't have to feel scared. So if they're put in a bad situation,
exactly.
If they're put in a situation where all of a sudden their life is in danger,
exactly.
They can protect themselves. And look, if you're not comfortable with a firearm, then you don't have to be comfortable with fire. There are other things that you can do, but being empowered as
yes.
opposed to, just waiting to become a victim.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was the number one thing, you know, that everyone is trying to bring up. The shooting, I was on stage an hour before the shooting happened here in Vegas. And immediately Fox wanted to talk about things, and I was on there talking, and they were, you know, trying to drive this narrative the other side of the fence, saying that this is so anti, we need to be anti-gun, anti-this. And it's like, well, less guns don't equate less madmen. So for me, it was really pushing that we need to be empowered. We need to not feel victim. And then getting death threats after the fact, ISIS death threats, all of this stuff, the more I've come out as a conservative and talk about 2A, people really get upset. And so my goal is to say it's because you're not educated. When you understand the OODA loop and you understand taking courses and you understand tactical stuff and hand-to-hand combat, it really is empowering. It's not supposed to be this threatening thing that the gun's going to hurt you. It's people with bad gun, you know, with bad mindset with any weapon. And then they don't necessarily use guns. They can use anything.
Yeah.
So we're going to, you know, we're going to ban acid, and we're going to ban, box cutters or cars or whatever, you know, whatever they choose to use. And every time it's different. We know that.
Unfortunately, you're right. And that's the thing. You know, I don't know any gun owner who thinks that, because I carry a gun, now I can protect myself against every conceivable threat out there. That's not what it's about.
No.
And I think that's part of what you're doing in combating these false narratives, as you say.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, let's get back to what it really is about.
Yeah.
Right? Forget all these distractions.
They're trying
to push
politics.
Forget about all the talking points. Absolutely they are. But that's, this is because the anti-gun movement, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. they don't even want to call themselves a gun control movement anymore. They're telling their supporters, don't use that phrase gun control. Talk about gun safety
instead.
Exactly. Right?
Exactly. Because we can all have fears. You know, my mom is a hunter. She's serious about shooting and all of that. And she always said, whatever you fear, you face, because it's then behind you. Someone yesterday saw me shooting a rifle out on the range, and they were like, I've always wanted to shoot one. I've never shot a rifle. And I said, well, whatever you fear, face it. Get behind it. You're in power, not the gun. But until you start working with weapons and understanding that, it is a fearful thing, because you should feel like, it could hurt me, or it could hurt someone. It can. So that's why you have to know the rules, and you have to pay attention. And everyone, when a gun is active, everyone's, supposed to be paying attention. We know that,
right,
as shooters, that we always pay attention no matter who has that gun.
But see, that's real gun safety, as opposed to, well, let's call these gun control bills gun safety bills and see if we can, deceive people that way.
You're not taking my gun away. It's not happening. It's not happening.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. Coming up later on the hour, Charles Cook of National Review. Next hour, it is a SCOTUS Power Hour. Dave Coppola of the Independence Institute talking about the Brett Kavanaugh SCOTUS pick. Also, Larry Keene of the National Shooting Sports Foundation. And right now, I want to welcome to the program from Faster, Colorado, Laura Carno is with us on the show. Laura, how are you today?
Hi, I'm doing very well. How are you?
I am excellent. I hear the gun control groups are telling us that if Brett Kavanaugh gets confirmed to the Supreme Court, he's gonna approve a law that would require all teachers to carry guns in schools, Laura.
I'm sure that'll happen.
Well, I got to say, I'm sorry, because I think this was a little bit of a hit piece that was done by the Denver Post and was picked up by Think Progress. But I had to kind of laugh when I saw this, because, the gun control advocates and their allies in the media, they've got such short memories. And it really is just all about the narrative and the messaging. It has so little to do with reality. So Think Progress had this piece yesterday. Colorado schools are arming teachers with no state oversight and few training standards. And oh my gosh, can you believe this is horrible? But here's the thing, Laura. They could have had state standards. They could have had state oversight. As a matter of fact, it was gun owners, it was people like yourself, who were actually advocating for that in the past legislative session. And it was the readers of Think Progress, it was the gun control activists, they were the ones opposing state oversight and state standards.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There was a bill sponsored by Senator Chris Hulbert that essentially put it into the hands of the sheriffs and said, your sheriffs, these are elected people. So if we don't like what they're doing, we can get rid of them. And the sheriffs should be able to say, you've had enough training to be able to carry on campus. And it was killed. I testified in favor of Senator Hulbert's bill. So what's interesting, so the Think Progress piece was based on the Denver Post piece. And the gal from the Denver Post, she was out with us for an entire day in the early June class. And as I read the piece, and I have to say, it was the front page Sunday above the fold of the Denver Post. That's pretty good coverage. And the title says, you know, 30 districts armed. And a lot of people just didn't know that. So it was good advertising for the fact that it's even happening. But as I read it, I thought, you know, we were together for the whole day. I told you the answers to these questions. And maybe she ran out of column space or something for the answers. But here's the thing, and this is a myth that I'll bust here. No state oversight, they say. So of the 32 or so states that have some provision for armed staff, whose legislatures have said your training should look like this, it looks exactly the same as our training. And what they fall back on is that the insurance companies who insure the school districts are the only ones saying what kind of training it should be. Okay, I don't care who's saying it. It's still adequate training. It's what legislatures across the country have set out. So to me, it's a big nothing burger, but, you know, we were front page Sunday Denver Post for whatever that's worth, and then Think Progress picked it up.
Yeah. Well, look, as you say, there's always those questions. When you see the piece appear, there's always those questions. Like, well, why didn't you just – right? But this does raise awareness. And frankly, you know, what's interesting is that obviously the knee-jerk reaction from anti-gun folks is, oh, can you believe this? I can't believe they're doing this without any oversight, without any training. But that also kind of acknowledges that, yeah, this is taking place and it's not going to go away. I mean, are you really going to tell these 30 school districts across the state of Colorado, hey, we're going to take away that decision that you made to have the armed school staff there? We're going to now tell you that you can't do this when you've got districts around the state that are contacting you all the time, and that number is growing. Maybe this is that first step towards ultimately accepting that this is something that some school districts are going to choose to do because it works.
Yeah. Yeah. And so to me, what the Post article said was, we can't say anymore that it shouldn't happen, but we are going to say that it should have oversight. So it was almost that admission that it's here to stay. And, you know, I'll take that. But it was real interesting in the follow-up conversation that I had after class with the reporter. And I was trying to provide her information on who the insurance company is that insures the vast majority of the schools and that sort of thing. And she called me back and she said, don't you think it's strange that you're the one with most of the information in the state on this, that the insurance company isn't releasing their names, the State Board of Education doesn't know who they are? And I said, I actually don't find that strange at all. I'm fine with decentralized school safety plans. And but it was, you know, and I'm not sure which way she leans. I can make a guess, but it seemed to she was having a difficulty reconciling that this thing could be happening, that school staff could have firearms on campus and nobody's in charge of it, so to speak. It was kind of an interesting conversation. But when it comes down to it, as I said, the standards that we have here in Colorado that FASTER Colorado fulfills, those are very similar to what happens across the country. And our friends at Buckeye Firearms Foundation in Ohio, their legislature lays this out, and it's the same thing. I have the same curriculum. So, you know, potato, potato, call it what you want. It is considered nationally adequate training for this sort of a thing.
Well, look, I mean, what they don't have the facts, Laura, on their side. So they'll ignore the facts. And again, they'll go with the innuendo. They'll go with that, you know, well, the only people overseeing this are insurance companies. And you know, the sad thing is, a lot of what I see on social media, the folks who, again, have that sort of knee-jerk response in opposition to this, they don't know about the training, right? They don't know what goes on in this FASTER program. And I know that you've done great outreach in bringing the media out. Stephen Gutowski, the Free Beacon, went through the all 3 days of training. But if you don't know, again, if all you know is armed teachers, they just want teachers strapped with guns and walking around. If you're not a gun owner, if you're not a parent, if you're not thinking about these things every day, I guess I can see why maybe you're going to freak out about it. I wouldn't, but I can see why people would. But again, do the research. You know, read beyond the scary headline and actually find out what's going on here. I mean, you still, I'm sure, run into this all the time. People think that you are mandating that every teacher carry a gun, or that these districts are mandating that every teacher carry a gun when they adopt armed school staff.
Right. And I wrote an article busting the myths of armed school staff. It's on our Faster Colorado website. For that exact reason, we kept hearing the same things over and over and over, including you can't make teachers carry. Nobody's forcing anybody to do this. It is a very small, select group of people at each school. It's not everybody's cup of tea. We're fine with it not being everybody's cup of tea. But I spoke to a Kiwanis club this morning. And so I do speak to some political clubs and gun clubs, but I also speak to a lot of just civic organizations that aren't political at all, just to provide them that information. Here is the current state of armed school staff in Colorado. This is what's going on. And this guy came up to me afterward and he said, I didn't even know that was the law. And I'm a lawyer. And because people would assume that it would be in the school safety part of the statutes. And it's not, it's an exemption to the concealed carry statute. So there are so many people who just don't know the facts. So part of what I do, you know, call it a PSA. I'm just trying to make sure that people understand what the facts are out there and what's actually going on. The other thing really quick about the Denver Post piece is that they called all of the school districts in Colorado, 180 some, and asked them all if they had armed staff. And some of them answered, some of them told them to go pound sand. But what was nice is I read in the paper a couple other school districts I didn't know who might be carrying, so I was able to call them and offer them free training.
That is beautiful. All right, well, at least that was a public service that was done.
Yes.
And you know, again, not every district going to give them that response. But I've got to think that this story, and again, the outreach that you've been doing to make school districts across the state of Colorado aware that this is an option for them, that this is paying off. And we're probably going to be seeing a lot more discussions among school board members, parents, faculty in the weeks and the months ahead.
Yeah, and there are a lot of school districts that are in process right now. Some school districts say we're going to meet in executive session and make a decision, and some say we want to have a long public process. We want the community to come in and provide their input. So they're all going at their own pace, which is fine. But I'm just kind of tracking the ones that I know of because we'll need to expand to fill the need if we need to add more classes. And my sense is that could happen. And you mentioned Stephen Gutowski going through our last class with the Washington Free Beacon. And folks should take a look at the pieces that he wrote. I think he said he was going to write three of them and two are out. The last one that he wrote, which was from using the voice of those school staffers who are going through the program and why they're doing it, it's very heartwarming. You really get the feeling of these people who would die to protect kids, and they want to make sure they can save life. It was a really, really good piece. And by the way, Stephen is a very good shot.
That does not surprise me, given that he is a NRA certified firearms instructor and somebody who genuinely loves teaching. That doesn't surprise me one bit. Laura, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program today. Thank you again for everything that you're doing out there. And hopefully one day soon I'll get a chance to actually go through the faster training.
Yes, I would like that. We still have a Friday, Saturday, Sunday in August that's open.
Okay, we'll talk about that. By the way, is that Wonder Woman behind you on the American flag there?
That is Wonder Woman. My class last year when we did our first class, presented me with a Wonder Woman at the end of it because I had gone from zero to a class in a very short period of time. So it was very sweet of them.
That's cool.
She is a reminder of what we've accomplished here.
Next time I get out to Colorado, I'll bring my Charlton Heston action figure behind me, and we can have them take a picture together. Wonder Woman and Charlton Heston awesome. Together again. Laura, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on the program today.
Thanks, Cam.
Also glad to know I'm not the only adult who still has action figures. So there you go. Not in the box. I had to take them out of the box. Actually, when it was funny, Cameron, yesterday when Danny Lyon was here, he had no idea that was Charlton Heston behind me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I forget who he thought that it was, but he had no idea. Let me pull this forward here. I don't know if Danny has just not ever seen Planet of the Apes, but this is Charlton Heston in Planet of the Apes.
He is not. He is
younger.
He
thought this was like a... Yeah, oh, we thought this was Chuck Norris. We thought this was like a karate gi.
Okay. I can see that. Yeah, Justin says he thought that too. So I could see it.
So there you go. I mean, except for the, you know, whole, like, NASA logo. I mean, it's not NASA, but whatever right. it was, whatever the space agency was for Charlton Heston. But, yeah, there you go. So... Now I kind of want a Chuck Norris action figure to go along with.
You should get one.
The Charlton Heston action figure.
You should have fake fights with them.
I could do that. Maybe that could just be our break material.
There
just,
you go. You know. Yeah, just two action figures fighting. I don't watch
stop
that.
Stop motion fighting between Charlton Heston.
The new Twitch.
And Chuck Norris. I love it. I love it. All right, well, birthday's coming up here. All right, coming up also in a few minutes, Charles Cook of National Review will join us. Top of the hour, we have today's Hero of the Day. We have our Deal of the Day. We have our Good Guy. And also Dave Coppola, the research director of the Independence Institute. Larry Keene with the National Shooting Sports Foundation going to join us. We've got more of the day's top stories ahead as well. So stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company coming up next. We're spending some time with Butch Wyden from Cryptek. Butch, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent. And Jen Dolphin from Prefix. How are you, sir?
Good morning. I'm doing great, thanks.
And this is an absolute beautiful beast behind us right here. What are we looking at?
Well, this is a very special and unique project. This is the Cryptek Edition Dodge Ram Minotaur 1500. And it's an aftermarket vehicle that Prefix, Jan's company, has assembled in collaboration with Cryptek, the NRA, and several other great brands in the industry.
So this is, we as NRA members, we've got the opportunity to actually win this truck, right?
Well, there's going to be 150 of these trucks made, but this truck specifically, NRA members are going to be able to win. Not just the truck, but an absolute amazing package of gear from great brands such as Weatherby, Leupold, Springfield Armory, Tenzing, Boyd Harness, Wiley X. There's about $25,000 Nosler ammo. There's about $25,000 of additional outdoor gear that's going to come along with this truck. And some lucky NRA winner is actually going to be able to win this truck that's well over $100,000.
Golly, okay. We're gonna talk more about how folks can win this. But first, Jan, let's talk about what's involved in this actual, you know, Dodge Ram Minotaur. What makes it so different and special?
Oh, absolutely. So just to clarify, Prefix, we're the company that builds most of the concept cars and prototypes for the auto industry. But every couple of years, we have a little fun. We find a vehicle that we think we could make better or enhance, or we think there's a niche market for. And so the Minotaur truck was built as an awesome daily driver. It's kind of built as the as an equivalent engineering-wise, like a Baja race truck. So on the highway, it's fantastic. But it's got 14 inches of suspension travel. It's the real deal. You can jump this thing, and it is just a beast.
Well, as somebody who actually owns a Dodge Ram, I can tell you that my Dodge Ram 1500 looks nothing like this Dodge Ram. I'm drooling right now. I'm having to actually keep my mouth closed.
That's perfect.
And so, you talk about the suspension. What about under the hood? What are we looking at in terms of, you know, horsepower? Right.
Comes with the 5.7 Hemi, which is a great motor for this truck. We do offer an optional supercharger. Like I said, we're building 150 of these. It's very low volume production. We love that exclusivity because that means that there's a good chance that the guys that own them are going to be the only guys in town that have them. And as Butch said, then there's one lucky guy who's going to get not only to win a Minotaur truck, but it's also going to be loaded with the prize package. So
this we're going to be able to start entering this lottery or this raffle here early March, and this is going to run for a year. Is that right?
That's my understanding. The NRA will really make an entire launch at the convention this year and open it up. And then all of the marketing and collateral start to go out and open up to NRA members. And then my understanding is that next year at the 2019 convention, they're going to pull a name out of a hat and somebody's going to win over $100,000 package.
I'm going to be entering. Are you going to be entering, Butch? Are you eligible? You're eligible, right?
I think so.
I mean, it's just a random drawing. All right,
if I won it, I'd turn it back in. You know, that's always cool when that happens.
And re-raffle it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a bold move for you, Butch.
Right.
I don't know that I'd be that generous, but this is amazing. And so tell me from your perspective, what was it like being involved in this project?
Well, it's kind of an interesting deal when when Prefix reached out to me and we started to have the discussion, hey, we'd like to talk to Cryptic about doing a Cryptic Edition Dodge Ram truck. You know, you have to be like, first call's like, yeah, right, whatever, you know. But then as we started the relationship and we started to understand what they were looking for and how this truck was a very, you know, badass vehicle, and they felt that it, our brand nested well with the attitude of the truck.
He's being too nice. we knew we had done a lot of testing with these vehicles. We already had started selling them. And I was looking for something that we could do to really increase the excitement. And when we learned about Cryptic and their camo pattern, it was the attitude that this truck needed. It's exactly what it needed. So starting to work with Butch, kind of understanding the background of their company, Prefix is known, our tagline is excellence is expected, and we knew what we were putting into the vehicle. But to add this Cryptic attitude, very patriotic, very cutting edge, awesome, awesome look to the truck, was just perfect. And we're getting the response because of it, for sure.
Well, for those who can't put down a deposit, we can buy a raffle ticket. NRABigTruckGiveaway.org. That's going to be the website that you need to go to enter this. Thanks so much for being a part of this edition of Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. Top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy as well. Hopefully, Charles Cook of National Review is going to be with us here in a fact, he's here right now, as a matter of fact. In another world, by the way, Charles Cook and I are at King's Dominion riding a roller coaster right now. But this is a pretty good consolation prize. Would you say, Charles?
Absolutely. It's always my second choice.
Well,
although we
yes.
could do this one day on a roller coaster. How about that?
Oh, okay. Let's do that. We'll get our calendars out. We'll make this happen. I am pleased that you could join us on the program today talking about the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. The NRA coming out in support of this nomination. National Shooting Sports Foundation very supportive as well. And then on the other side, Charles, the gun control groups wringing their hands. A piece of The Guardian today where they're expressing concern that, you know, this could mean that all of a sudden the Supreme Court starts hearing Second Amendment cases again and start ruling in favor of our right to keep and bear arms. This is horrible if you're a gun control advocate.
It is indeed. Look, the Bill of Rights exists in order to protect certain rights. One of those rights is the individual right to keep and bear arms, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. I have seen gun control advocates saying that Brett Kavanaugh is pro-gun, pro-Second Amendment. No, he is somebody who approaches the law in a particular way, and I think the only legitimate way, which is as a set of rules to be followed by judges up until the point that they are repealed or changed. He's somebody who believes that the original public meaning of the Constitution should be respected by judges. It shouldn't be changed to comport with a judge's personal opinions or changed to comport with whatever is fashionable this week. And as a result, he is somebody who is very likely, if not guaranteed, to see the Second Amendment as he should see all the amendments, as a strict protection of individual rights. So in that sense, he will be disappointing to gun control groups, but only insofar as the Second Amendment itself is disappointing to gun control groups, because it does act as a check on their ambitions.
Absolutely. And you know, you make a very good point about Judge Kavanaugh as opposed to being pro-gun or pro-Second Amendment, actually looking at the Constitution. In fact, in the dissent in the Heller 2 case, which a lot of folks are going to be talking about between now and the ultimate vote to confirm Judge Kavanaugh onto the Supreme Court, you know, he even said, I grew up in Washington, D.C., I've seen the violence in Washington, D.C., and there may be some gun control rules that I'd like to see in place, but that doesn't mean that the Constitution allows them. And you have to look at what it is that the Constitution actually allows. And what we've seen from a lot of these lower courts around the country is that these judges are going out of their way, Charles, to uphold these gun control rules, even if they have to rewrite the Heller decision in order to do so.
I agree. I think that the dissent in Heller 2 was extremely encouraging, and I think that for a couple of reasons. The first one is he understood that the standard laid out by the Supreme Court was that weapons were protected if they were in common use. And he points out in the dissent that it unequivocally applies to semi-automatic handguns, and that there is no reason, legal or otherwise, to assume that there is any justification for failing to apply the same rules to semi-automatic rifles. Even if you were going in some sort of utilitarian direction and arguing that the government has a special interest in banning dangerous weapons, you wouldn't pick semi-automatic rifles. He points out in his dissent, look, there is an exemption made, and we can argue whether this is good or not, but there is an exemption made in Heller for automatic weapons, but there is no exemption made for so-called assault weapons or for semi-automatic rifles. And if you follow the logic through the in common use standard and also the explicit protection of semi-automatic handguns, then you have to apply it as well to semi-automatic rifles. Now, that is encouraging because it shows that he is somebody who is prepared to uphold the Heller decision as it is written, not as he would like it to be written. But it's also encouraging because we have seen in recent years that the court has been unwilling to step in when the lower courts have refused to do their job.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen dissents from the denial of cert from Justice Scalia before he died, from Justice Thomas, and now from Justice Gorsuch. Now, given that Judge Kavanaugh was willing to uphold the law as written as a lower court judge, given that he dissented, it seems reasonable to infer that when he is on the Supreme Court, he will side with Thomas and Gorsuch in insisting that the court has a responsibility to step in and ensure that the lower courts are not inventing frivolous reasons to maintain laws that are unconstitutional. And that will be a change to the status quo. I mean, I am obviously thrilled about this pick, but it is worth pointing out to people that they have to stay engaged. Scalia was replaced by Gorsuch. That did not change the makeup of the court. Kavanaugh will be replacing Kennedy on guns. That will not change the makeup of the court, except perhaps in willingness to step in and reprimand lower courts for failing to uphold precedent. This is not a battle that has been won. It was a 5-4 decision in Heller. It was a 5-4 decision in McDonald. It would still, it seems, be 5-4 today were those cases reheard. We shouldn't overstate it, but there is a small change in the right direction, it seems, in how willing this judge has been to flesh out Heller as it is written, not how he would like it to be written.
I think you're spot on with that. And this is something that frankly the gun control groups have noted that the court hasn't heard a case in 8 years, so we've had all of these lower court decisions that the Supreme Court has not reviewed, and so the Ninth Circuit said, nah, you don't have a right to carry a concealed firearm. We're gonna bypass entirely the question about whether you have the right to bear arms. You had, I think it was the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, say that yeah, semi-automatic firearms, they're protected under the Second Amendment, and a ban would infringe on your rights. But it's okay because there's a public safety benefit that the government is alleging. And so as long as they say that there's a public safety benefit, then they can infringe on your rights all they want. And we've seen some awful decisions, and it's I'm sure the gun control groups would have loved to have had these decisions heard and upheld by the Supreme Court, but this is the next best thing for the gun control groups. And it's interesting, over the past 8 years, Charles, for instance, when it comes to right to carry, when the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said that Illinois' ban on the carrying of firearms was unconstitutional, the gun control groups did not appeal that to the Supreme Court. When Washington, D.C. had its good cause requirement for concealed carry struck down by the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, the gun control groups did not appeal that case to the Supreme Court. They did not want to run that risk because, as you say, the votes in these cases have been 5-4. Their consolation has been, well, at least the court's not hearing these cases anymore.
Yeah.
And this does, it doesn't guarantee that the court is going to hear cases going forward, but it does make it, I think, undoubtedly more likely that the court will hear these cases going forward.
Well, I think that's right. And it is important. I mean, the remarkable restoration of the right to keep and bear arms that we've seen over the last 20 years has not primarily been the product of the courts. And that is one reason that it has been so, why it has been so broad. It has primarily come from people, public opinion, grassroots activism, voting. This has been a voter-led change. And that is a good thing, because you cannot live if you expect to be free in a country in which you rely solely upon the courts for the maintenance of your rights. You have to have a democratic culture that respects those rights as well. Nevertheless, it is, of course, vital that the court is there as a check, and for two main reasons. The first one is, although there is now a broad-based coalition that has pushed for the maintenance of Second Amendment rights, it doesn't obtain everywhere. It doesn't obtain in New Jersey. It doesn't obtain in California. But those people are Americans, too, and they are absolutely as entitled to have their rights upheld as anybody else is, and the courts are going to have to do that. And Justice Kavanaugh takes us closer to a position in which that will happen. And the second reason is that sometimes you have wave elections, you know, as in 2008. Now, certainly it was quickly reversed in 2010. But if the Democratic supermajorities had wanted to in 2008-09, they could have passed sweeping gun control. And now they would have been quickly kicked out of office, but it would still have been litigated. And at that point, you really need a Supreme Court that is willing to step in and say, no, the laws that you have just passed are unconstitutional and they will not stand. And that is, of course, why it is so important that Justice Kennedy has been replaced or will be replaced by someone such as Kavanaugh, and why it was so important that Scalia was replaced with someone such as Neil Gorsuch.
Talking to you with a friend, Charles Cook from National Review. So I'm curious, Charles, I'll ask you to prognosticate just a little bit. Last night, Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer said he opposes this nomination with everything he has. And what he has are, you know, 48 colleagues who are Democrats in the Senate. That's what he has. So he needs a couple of Republicans to peel away. I think there was a reporting from Wired sources earlier this afternoon. Susan Collins telling reporters that Kavanaugh is, quote, clearly qualified for the job. I know that's not her saying that she's guaranteed to vote to confirm him, but it's a positive a sign there if you are a supporter of Brett Kavanaugh, and probably something that sent Chuck Schumer to the roll aides hearing Senator Collins say that. What do you think this confirmation fight is likely to look like? How ugly do you think it is likely to get? But do you think that ultimately Brett Kavanaugh is going to be confirmed?
I think it will be ugly. I think there is enough rage on the other side at the moment to ensure that. I think there will be a great deal of play acting from Democratic senators. I'm sure many of them oppose him, and they're entirely entitled to oppose him. The Senate gets to decide whether the president's nominee sits on the Supreme Court. But I think some of the language that will be used will be base indulgence rather than anything else. I do think he will be appointed, yes. I think the Democrats are in a difficult position. I mean, if you look at the Senate map, there seem to be two choices here. One is you convince a few Democrats, Manchin, Donnelly, Heitkamp, perhaps Tester, perhaps Bill Nelson in Florida, who's been making warm noises on this appointment. So, you know, you either convince them now, yes, you need to support him and then get on with running for the Senate, or you can block him, we'll beat you in November, and then we'll do it on our own terms afterwards. I can't see how the mathematics works for the Democrats here. I am, of course, not a crystal ball. I have been wrong in the past, but I don't see this one being particularly difficult.
Charles Cook with National Review. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Thank you so much for your time, and let's go ride a roller coaster here soon.
Absolutely.
All right. Charles Cook with us here on Cam and Company. Make sure you're following Charles on Twitter at Charles C.W. Cook. And, you know, listen, Charles, I think, is right. This is going to get ugly. And we don't really know how this is going to work. Axios has a poll out today conducted with the folks at SurveyMonkey. They're a tweet about this. The Senate is looking pretty grim for Democrats in the midterms. So according to their polling, now keep in mind, it's July. We don't vote till November. A lot can change between now and November. And this is one poll, so take it with however many grains of salt you want. They show right now Democrats likely to lose three seats, at least, in the November elections. They say Donnelly in Indiana is in trouble. They say Heitkamp in North Dakota in trouble. Bill Nelson in Florida in trouble. Now, they also show the same poll that in Arizona, Democrats likely to pick up a seat. Also in Nevada right now, it's a very close race between the Democrat Jackie Rosen and a Democrat or a Republican Dean Heller. So Democrats could flip a couple of seats, but according to this poll, even under the rosiest of projections, Democrats could end up losing a net number of seats. Republicans would be able to improve on their numbers in the midterm elections in the Senate. And part of this is just the math. There are so many Democrats who are up for re-election in this cycle and up for election in states that Donald Trump won in 2016. So if you are one of those red state Democrats and you're trying to convince voters, listen, I'm not a rubber stamp for Donald Trump, but I'm not a rubber stamp for Chuck Schumer. And you're in a state like Montana or West Virginia or North Dakota or Indiana or Missouri, states that have not only a strong tradition of gun ownership, but a lot of gun owners who vote. And again, this is a vote that, as Charles said, doesn't necessarily fully change the dynamics of the court in terms of how a court would rule, but may very well change the equation in terms of the willingness of the court to start hearing Second Amendment cases again. Yeah, if your senator's voting against that candidate, they're voting against your gun rights. How's that going to play in November? Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company next. I want to welcome from Reason Writing in National Review, Mr. Declan McCullough is with us. What I love about this piece is that it's not just empty rhetoric of, doggone it, why won't the Supreme Court agree to hear a case? You say, look, it's time for Congress to act, and Congress can do so. And the way that you start out your column, Declan, I got to say, is absolutely extraordinary. Quote, states controlled by the Democratic Party have chosen to ignore an individual right protected by an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Rights of millions of law-abiding Americans in those states have been routinely violated by Byzantine rules and prohibitions, and courts have turned a blind eye to those abuses. The U.S. Supreme Court could intervene, but instead it has chosen to leave unconstitutional laws on the books. Some prominent Democrats have called for repealing the amendment, and magazine articles have offered elaborate justifications. You could be talking about today, but you're actually writing about 1870 in the 15th Amendment.
Exactly. I mean, that's the point. We've been through this before. We've seen cases where we have a constitutional amendment protecting an individual right that certain states have ignored with the help of the judiciary in those states. And you've even had folks talking about ignoring it. And the answer was, well, it took us a while to figure this out. The result was the civil rights era of the 1950s and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And that actually enforced the 15th Amendment. It took us a long time to get there. I hope it doesn't take us as long this time, but it put a lot of burdens on the states. The states didn't like it. But in the end, if you have a constitutional right protected by an amendment, let's enforce it. I understand and I'll agree that it's a little easier to talk about it, talk about getting this law through Congress. But at some point we have to find other ways if the Supreme Court hasn't decided to hear a case in 8 years.
Well, absolutely. And you know, we've seen a number of justices, including Clarence Thomas recently, you write about this, who've authored, you know, minority opinions, dissenting opinions, saying it's time for the court to actually hear these cases. We're treating the Second Amendment as if it's an orphaned right. But if under the current makeup of the court, we keep seeing the court punt. It's been 8 years since McDonald was decided, striking down the city of Chicago's handgun ban. As you say, maybe it is time for Congress to act, because these lower court decisions, Declan, they keep becoming more and more egregious. You write about a case, a federal judge out in California, Judge John Cronstad, recently dismissing a challenge to California's carry laws. Because in California, the average Californian, if you live in Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, any of the big population centers, and you're an average law-abiding Californian, you cannot exercise your right to bear arms. You can't do it. You're not going to be able to get a concealed carry license. You can't openly carry a firearm for self-defense. That is a right that is not being regulated. That's a right that's being infringed upon.
Exactly right. I mean, sure, if you're the relatively small number of California gun owners living in the Sierras or way up towards the Oregon border, it's going to be essentially a shall issue county. But this is the discretion of local law enforcement, and most local law enforcement in all the population areas will not issue you that permit. And so I live in California. I'm seeing this firsthand. It's a target-rich environment. I've been writing about there's four articles in the last month, I think, about what California gone off the rails. But it's not just California residents. I mean, what happens if you are a law-abiding gun owner in Montana or Wyoming and you want to travel to a state that might be on the coast? It's not going to recognize your concealed carry permit. Well, why not? This is something that Congress can step in and do.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by our friends at Hornady, starts right this second on the program this hour. Our friend Dave Koppel, research director at the Independence Institute, will join us on the program talking about the pick, Brett Kavanaugh, for the Supreme Court. Also, later in the hour, Larry Keene of the National Shooting Sports Foundation talking about that very same issue. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy coming up here in just a couple of minutes. But, you know, again, we've been talking all afternoon long about the selection of Brett Kavanaugh by President Donald Trump to the Supreme Court of the United States. What this means for gun owners, this is, I think, unquestionably a good move. You heard the praise from Chris Cox of NRA's Institute for Legislative Action, talking about mobilizing these 6 million members. And again, you know, you don't have to wait to get that email from NRA's Institute for Legislative Action. You can go ahead and contact your senator now. There's nothing stopping you, and there's no law against it. They do need to be hearing from you, and they're going to need to continue to hear from you. We've heard that this is going to be the most expensive Supreme Court confirmation fight in history. And as I said, if you live in one of those states like West Virginia, Missouri, North Dakota, Montana, Indiana, you are going to be inundated with ads. You're going to get it every time you go on Facebook, every time you go on Twitter, every time you turn on the TV or the radio, you're going to be hearing ads telling you to either support this confirmation or oppose this confirmation. All of your friends, all your neighbors, all the fellow residents there where you live, going to be hearing that same message. So you've got to make sure that you're using your voice. Make sure that you're talking to other gun owners as well. Make sure that they understand this is not a guarantee. This is not a lock. It may very well be that Chuck Schumer is you know, fighting this fight without a lot of tools in his toolbox. They're still going to fight this. I mean, you've got Democrats right now who are saying that Democrats just shouldn't show up. They should just not go to work. Because right now, I actually saw somebody make this argument today. Seriously. Right now, John McCain's in Arizona. So there are only 50 Republicans that are actually there in D.C. And if all of the Democrats just stay away, well, then Republicans don't have enough for a quorum. And then the business of the Senate can't take place. And everything just grinds to a halt. Can't have a vote if you don't have a quorum now, can you? Now, look, I think that's an extraordinarily stupid idea. I don't think it's likely that Chuck Schumer is going to go that route. But Chuck Schumer said last night he's going to do everything he can, everything in his power to oppose this confirmation. So they're going to go all out trying to stop this vote from happening before November. And it is going to be up to us as voters and us as constituents to let our senators know we want a vote. And to demand from our senators, where do you stand? You know, we're already seeing the usual suspects. I think it was Chris Murphy coming out last night declaring Brett Kavanaugh to be a Second Amendment extremist. Didn't that just make you smile a little bit, Cameron, when you saw that tweet?
Yes, I have to say it was. And most of the meltdown yesterday was satisfying to watch, I have to say. As soon as the pick was over, I switched to MSNBC because I just wanted to watch the parade of misery. It was just, it was must-see TV. It was fantastic.
See, I don't have a TV in my home office, but I was watching online at whitehouse.gov last night the announcement itself, and then I went back onto social media to get my Schadenfreude and might get my fix that way. And you're right, and it was for a while. Look, it was glorious. I mean, I'll be honest with you, it was glorious. I mean, I felt so good when I saw that comment by Chuck Schumer, and I just wrote back, "You got nothing. You have nothing." It felt really good to type it. But honestly, as the night went on, I did think about what would my reaction have been. How would I have been feeling last night if it was President Clinton and it wasn't, Merrick Garland replacing Antonin Scalia, but now we're talking about Terry McAuliffe replacing Anthony Kennedy, right? And now we're talking about six judges, maybe, that's going to be opposed to our right to keep him in arms for decades and decades to come. And I got a little, here's the thing. I don't think that the folks on the left have much to worry about in terms of the Handmaid's Tale coming true if Brett Kavanaugh gets elected to the Supreme Court. I just don't. I don't think that's going to come to pass. I think a lot of their fears are, frankly, a little unreasonable. But if we had six anti-gun justices on the Supreme Court, absolutely every gun ban that you could think of would be upheld. Every restriction on the right to carry would be upheld. Your rights would largely exist on paper. And that piece of paper would be in the National Archives. And it's really faded. And you can go visit your rights if you want to, but you got to squint really hard to read them. That's what our right to keep and bear arms would look like if we had President Clinton making this announcement last night. So, on the one hand, I do understand the freak out, because I'd be freaking out if it was President Clinton. On the other hand, I just don't foresee the theocratic future envisioned by some on the left if Brett Kavanaugh actually takes his place on the Supreme Court. I think a lot of their fears are a little overblown. All right, when we I tell you what, as I said, we're going to be talking a lot about this hour. So let's transition right now to our hero of the day, our deal of the day, our good guy of the day. Hero of the day out in California, Fox 40 in Sacramento, Dateline Wilton, California in Sacramento County, where sheriff's deputies were called out to what was described as a gruesome scene on Sunday afternoon. Sean Hampton of the Sheriff's Department says the deputies actually first got there in a helicopter. He said arriving, they started observing what was going on and piecing together the details from what they saw from the air, as well as information that was coming in from the complainant. Well, the complainant was a homeowner there in Wilton, California, who had hired some guys to do some work around his property. And he said one of the guys that he hired started attacking another guy that he hired with a hammer, beating him repeatedly in the head with this hammer. The alleged attack, according to Fox 40, only came to an end when the homeowner grabbed his shotgun and pointed at the suspect until law enforcement was able to land the helicopter, run over, and take the guy into custody. Now, the sheriff's spokesman, Sean Hampton, said that homeowner using that gun to keep the suspect at bay was the correct thing to do. He said you have to make that decision, and being the circumstances that were occurring at that location, I think he made the right decision, because there was a considerable amount of injury being sustained to this victim by the suspect and potentially life-threatening. In other words, homeowner may have saved this man's life. The victim in this case had to undergo surgery. Officials still investigating the attack, but that suspect is in custody, and that homeowner out in Wilton, California, he is today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day today from the Boston Herald. Mayor of Springfield, Massachusetts, is publicly wondering now why are repeat offenders in his community getting low bail? As the Boston Herald reports, the mayor of Springfield, already reeling from the deaths of three women found on a local property, is demanding to know, quote, what the hell is going on with the low bail for repeat violent offenders. Dominic Sarno, the mayor of Springfield, asked that question days after the seventh homicide in Springfield, Massachusetts this year. 32-year-old Dante King, 27-year-old Aaron Kelly Griffin, pleaded not guilty last Friday to armed assault with intent to commit robbery, not charged in the murder of 34-year-old Corey Drummer. That case remains open, but the mayor says he has seen enough. He said in a statement, quote, Dante King was just arrested on stolen and loaded gun charges on July the 3rd and was promptly let go by our court system. He said, oh, I know some judges and defense attorneys will say, Mr. Mayor, you don't understand the bail system. It's only supposed to make sure that a violent, repeat violent offender comes back to court. Sarno said, well, Mr. King did, but now it's to do with a fatal shooting. What the hell does it take to hold and keep these repeat violent offenders off of our streets and out of our neighborhoods? He said, this is at times demoralizing. We're doing our job. I ask the courts to do theirs. Sarno, according to the Boston Herald, made a similar appeal 3 weeks ago, or several weeks ago, after three bodies were found at the home of Stuart Weldon. The 40-year-old career criminal had been court-ordered to wear a GPS monitoring device. A warrant had been out for his arrest since he failed to meet his probation officer back on February the 12th. It's July now. Weldon was arrested after a police chase and was held on charges of kidnapping and beating a woman who told cops she had been held against her will for a month. Sexually assaulted repeatedly during that time. Weldon right now being held on $1 million bail. And the Boston Herald notes that Sarno's criticism comes as a judge in Salem, Massachusetts, is also under fire for his decision. Salem Superior Court Judge Timothy Q. Feely gave a heroin dealer probation instead of prison time, calling it a, quote, money crime. Because, you know, nobody's dying from heroin overdoses in the United States right now. So, you know, you're selling heroin. It's just a money crime. Not really. That man's since been taken into custody by federal immigration officers, by the way. Feely also under scrutiny for lowering the bail of a man who weeks later was charged with killing a cop in Maine. We've talked about this issue with Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League over the past couple of months. And I'm glad to see that there are more politicians who are starting to ask these questions. But you know who's not asking these questions? You know the politicians I've never seen asking this question? Massachusetts top law enforcement officer, Maura Healey, the attorney general. I haven't heard Maura Healey wonder once why it is that these repeat violent offenders are continually getting slaps on the wrist and sent back out on the streets. I guess because Maura Healey's more concerned with those legal gun owners there in the state of Massachusetts and how to turn them in to criminals. All right, on to our good guy of the day. From CBS 42 in Alabama, Shelby County. Alabaster in Columbiana, Alabama. Community members there coming to the aid of a police officer and his family who recently lost their son. Tyler Stovall fought bone cancer for 4 years, went through remission once, but passed away June 11th, leaving behind a wife and a three-year-old daughter. Tyler's wife, Meredith, says, we're going to miss Tyler. We're still grieving. And we miss him so much, but we know that he's up there watching over us, and we take peace in that. Tyler's dad, Mike Keller, says it is hard every day. He is a police officer there in the county. And again, these local communities, Alabaster and Columbiana, stepping up to help the family out with medical bills. Tyler did not have insurance at age 24 when he passed away. And the local community stepping up, as is local police department, Vestavia Hills Police Department, where Mike Keller works. Keller said, it makes me feel really good that they support me, not just at work, but when you really need supporting, not just the funeral. But all the way through this, there's been a GoFundMe page that was set up to help the family out. I was going to tweet this out. The GoFundMe's actually already been met, and then some there in that local community. And, you know, again, we don't hear these types of stories that much. I mean, this is not going to be national news. Frankly, I'm a little surprised it made the local news there in Shelby County, Alabama. But I can tell you, in not just in small towns, but even in neighborhoods, in bigger cities, despite the polarization and the politicization of everything under the sun these days, despite the vitriol that we seem to treat our fellow Americans with on a daily basis, you can still find these communities coming together to helping out those in need. And in this case, it's the good folks there in Shelby County, Indiana, or Shelby County, Alabama, helping out the Stovall family and the Keller family in their time of grieving and of loss. So to those good folks out there in Shelby County, Alabama, we thank you for being some of the many, many good guys out there. All right, when we return here on Cam and Company, Dave Koppel joins us, Research Director at the Independence Institute. We are going to delve deeper into Brett Kavanaugh's views on the right to keep and bear arms, taking a look at the Heller 2 case. Later in the hour, you'll hear from Larry Keene with the National Shooting Sports Foundation about the Kavanaugh nomination. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company coming up next.
We're talking with Holly Sullivan from the great state of Connecticut and Lauren Hartnett from New York City. And you all are both with the D.C. Project, which is going to be happening later on in the year. And this is really interesting. I mean, you're really trying to get a nationwide voice to go to D.C. and to talk to lawmakers about our Second Amendment rights, right?
Absolutely. And I think we've got some of the toughest states in the United States to meet with. And we kind of power through our meetings and do the best that we can.
And they tend to split us up just because, like last year, I was with Arizona. So Arizona is a very two-way friendly state. So they do definitely try to split us up and have harder states versus easier states just so that we can really come at it at full force and give different directions. I mean, being from New York City, I had Bloomberg as a mayor who steamrolled against the Second Amendment, and to the point where people who were initially against common sense gun control turned around and was like, wait, no, you're legitimately trying to just steamroll over the Constitution. And I think it's really important that we're trying to bring it back in New York City, especially the right, more so the rest of the country, but New York City is just, everybody laughs when they say I'm
But they shouldn't, because, you know, I always say this on the show, our Second Amendment isn't contingent on our zip code. It's not contingent on the population density of where we live. It's the same right for me in Virginia as it is for you in New York City. It's just that your government doesn't recognize it as a right.
Right.
And the same with Connecticut. I mean, good Lord, you've got Governor Daniel Malloy and yeah. Senator Chris Murphy. I mean, it must be awful.
It's definitely a challenge. And what a lot of people don't realize is that Connecticut actually has a constitution that specifically outlines that Connecticut residents have the right to protect themselves and of the state. So, you know, we're in a situation that we have a constitutional right from the United States, but we also have it within our state as well. And then we had the passage of SB 1160. And I work, you know, with the D.C. project at the federal level, but then I'm also involved with the Connecticut Citizens Defense League at the state level. And I'll tell you, you know, we are with those legislators every step of the way, trying to explain to them what the mechanics are of the firearm. We just did a legislative shoot, which worst timing is that we did the legislative shoot the day before the disaster here in Vegas. So here we had taken these legislators to the range, and we taught them about functionality and what is a semi-automatic firearm, and so that they were just a little bit more empowered. And we didn't pressure them. We didn't have an ask. We weren't there to, you know, ask them to vote on anything or do anything. We just want them to understand nomenclature and understand functionality so that when the bills come across their desk, they have a bit of a better understanding of what they're talking about, what they mean, because there's a lot of big scary words out there that they don't necessarily understand. So if we can empower those legislators with knowledge in advance, I think it does us a tremendous amount of good. But then, of course, we did that event, and it was a tremendously successful event. And then the next day, we had the Vegas tragedy. And, you know, at the end of the day, we don't want guns in the hands of bad guys, right? We're all working towards the same goal, so we got to figure out a way to get there.
Yeah, I think part of the problem, though, is that your governor, your former mayor, they see you as bad guys, right? Or they say, well, if you own a gun, then, you know, a bad guy could take that gun from you, they could steal it. So it's better that you don't have a gun, just on the off chance that a bad guy might get a hold of it. Which, I don't know about you, that doesn't really resonate with me logically.
Right, and I mean, New York was infamous for the SAFE Act after Sandy Hook, and after that, none of it made sense. And that was pure fact, and that was proof of how legislators keep pushing laws that don't end up making sense. When they passed the SAFE Act, it was based off of pure emotion, and there were laws that made the law enforcement officers end up breaking them, like you can't have more than 7 rounds in a magazine. But what are you going to, so you're going to take the extra 3 out of PD and make them walk around with 7? Because I'm pretty sure the bad guys don't have 7. So that was proof. And when we brought that to legislators, and I even sat down with my congressman, bailed on me twice. Here in Staten Island, when I tried to speak to him at the home office, and then in D.C. when I was there with the D.C. project, he ended up coming to my gun club. I called him out on it. I sat there through a whole meeting for an hour and a half while he sat there and, you know, spoke to the other members of my gun club. I was the only woman in the room out of 60 men. And as soon as he's getting ready to bolt out the door, my president's like, no, wait, you have to listen to what she has to say. And I said, you left? You told me just now you have no idea about the laws. You have no idea about firearms, nothing. We're giving you that education. We're sitting here telling you, we'll tell you when something comes across the table, we'll talk to you about it. We'll just let you know what it means. You're not going to put a bill on something or vote for something that you don't know anything about if it was anything else.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. Larry Keene of the National Shooting Sports Foundation joining us in just a little while. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Research Director from the Independence Institute, Mr. Dave Koppel, is with us on the program. Dave, good afternoon, sir.
It's a very good afternoon indeed.
It is. I always start off the show and I say, good, whatever day it is. Today, I had to stop myself and said, no, great Tuesday. It is a, It is a great Tuesday. This was, I think, a great pick by President Trump last night. I'm genuinely excited, Dave. And we had gone through over the past couple of days some of the names that were on the supposed short list of candidates, and there were, frankly, there were no red flags that I really saw from any of the names that were seen as the quote unquote finalists for the SCOTUS seat. But when President Trump named Brett Kavanaugh last night, he nominated an individual who has dealt with Second Amendment issues in the past, who has a record. And frankly, it is a record that is one of recognition and respect for the Constitution and the rights protected in our Bill of Rights.
I think that that's exactly right, and I will also say I'm kind of pleased because his opinion, which we're going to talk about, defending the Second Amendment, cited my law school textbook. So this is the second Supreme Court nominee in a row who has had an opinion on as a circuit judge that cites something I wrote. So
I got to ask, because that's never ever going to happen to me. No Supreme Court nominee is ever going to cite. Well, I saw it on Cam and Company. So what does that feel like, Dave, when you see this citation and it's something that you wrote, it's an argument that you've put out there, and these other really sharp legal minds say, yeah, that actually makes sense to me?
Oh, it's great. I mean, that's why you people become law professors, or at least why it's the reason why some of them do, and it's not maybe not the main thing you're after, but it's you know, part of being a law professor is you're trying to educate the public and the profession about the law. So it's nice to see that that's succeeding sometimes.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's get into this case, and I'll maybe this is a good place to start. What actually got cited by Judge Kavanaugh? What in your law review article did Judge Kavanaugh refer to in his dissent in Heller 2?
Well, it's the law school textbook, Firearms Law and the Second Amendment, which is the first law school textbook on the right to arms. It was Nicholas Johnson of Fordham is the lead author. I'm number two, and then we also George Moxley from Southern Illinois and Michael O'Shea from Oklahoma City Law School. We're the four co-authors. So it cited the textbook for the basic fact that a large percentage of rifles sold these days are semi-automatics.
You know, and in this dissent, I mean, not only does Judge Kavanaugh talk about, because one of the issues at question was the ban in D.C. on semi-automatic rifles that the D.C. had deemed to be quote-unquote assault weapons, And Judge Kavanaugh talked about the number of rifles that are sold in America today that are semi-automatic, but he also talked about the history of these semi-automatic rifles. I mean, Dave, you know, we hear from anti-gun activists that these are modern battlefield weapons of war, and yet Judge Kavanaugh was able to go back and say, okay, so if we actually look at the history, I mean, you've got, going back to the late 1800s, semi-automatic firearms that are in common use by law-abiding Americans for a variety of lawful purposes. This is nothing new here.
No, not at all. In fact, he talking about the American market for semi-automatic rifles in particular, he cites a book called Forgotten Winchesters, which is sadly out of print right now, but it talks about the introduction of the Winchester and Remington semi-automatic rifles and shotguns in 1903 through 1906, and what a huge success they were on the commercial market.
Okay, so again, this is, I think, just an example of the type of research and reasoning that you see from Judge Kavanaugh. But let's get into sort of the meat of this opinion, because he wrote the dissenting opinion, Dave. So his argument did not carry the day among his colleagues. Two other judges on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit said that the gun ban in D.C. was fine. The semi-automatic ban was a fine. That the registration requirements were okay. They looked at these laws through the lens of intermediate scrutiny and found that while the government has this compelling interest, and they've kind of tried to tailor their laws so it's not overly broad, and there's nothing in the Heller decision, the McDonald decision, that would preclude D.C. from being able to do this. So so these laws are okay. They can be upheld, and there's really no way that they can be constitutionally challenged. First of all, what's your take on the majority opinion in Heller 2? What's your take on where these judges got it wrong?
Well, so the majority opinion says we're going to apply intermediate scrutiny, which is a mild form of judicial review. And doing that, it says the ban on so-called assault weapons, which is very broad, is okay. And so is the ban on magazines over 10 rounds. The registration system that D.C. had created after Heller, you know, in effect, it's a licensing system, because you can't register the gun unless you're approved by the government. That some of that was okay because that was common and things like that had been around a long time, but other parts were novel. And so the majority sent it back to the trial court for more factual and argumentation development. And then ultimately, in a case called Heller 3, in which Judge Kavanaugh was not on the D.C. Circuit panel, a 2-1 majority upheld some of the registration rules, but not all of them. For example, it said there's no point in saying that registrations are going to expire automatically every 3 years. There's no benefit to the government from putting people through the hassle of having to re-register on a continual basis, because, you know, the only thing D.C. says about, well, why do you make people re-register, is, well, we'll see if they're eligible again. But the court says, well, you can just do that anyway. You can run a background check on anybody anytime you want. And, well, what if, you know, what if the gun's lost or stolen and we need to get the person to report that? And the Heller 3 majority says, well, you already have a separate law that says you have to report a lost or stolen gun, or if you change your address. So there's no real benefit in requiring continuous re-registration. So there even under the majority's approach, there are some good results from that. But the big problem is they, on pretty weak evidence, uphold the ban on lots of semi-automatic rifles and on all magazines over 10.
Okay. Now we get into the dissent by Judge Kavanaugh, and it's interesting, Dave, because, you know, over the years we've talked a lot about the reliance of these lower courts on intermediate scrutiny when looking at these gun control laws. That sort of vague, fuzzy middle ground. It's not the higher standard of review. Judge Kavanaugh says, forget intermediate scrutiny, forget strict scrutiny. What the Heller case told us is that we need to look at the text, the history, and tradition when we are determining the constitutionality of these gun laws. And that's something that you and I have not talked a lot about. So can you talk about what that methodology that Judge Kavanaugh referred to and relied upon actually looks like in practice?
Sure. And in fact, over half of Judge Kavanaugh's opinion is a very thorough explanation of why text, history, and tradition is the methodology that was used in Heller and then in McDonald versus Chicago against the Chicago handgun ban, that they didn't set up these kind of interest balancing tests. That's what Justice Breyer wanted to do in his dissent, which the majority rejected. And instead they said, you can't ban arms that are in common use and are typically used by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes. And obviously, handguns fit in that category. And that's what Heller said. That's how Judge Kavanaugh read the opinion. And so he says, well, okay, now let's apply this to semi-automatic rifles. Are they in common use? Obviously. You know, been around for a very long time, ever since those Winchesters of 1903. Many, many millions owned. There are a large percentage of rifles that are currently sold. And they're certainly not more dangerous than a semi-automatic handgun, which is most handguns these days. They fire at the same rate, and rifles in general, including semi-automatics, are used much, much, much less often in crime than are handguns in general, including semi-automatics. And so under Heller, you can't ban semi-automatic handguns, because that's the large majority of handguns, and Heller says you can't ban handguns. And so Judge Kavanaugh says, well, obviously, the same principle has to apply to semi-automatic rifles. And on magazines over 10, Judge Kavanaugh's approach is, well, we actually don't know from how the case has developed so far, if they're common or not, what they're typically used for, things like that. So he would have sent that back to the trial court for more factual development. But, you know, you and I and the listeners to this program know what the answer to that is from factual development. These magazines have been around since about the time of the Civil War, and magazines over 10, and even before that in some earlier things going back, you know, to King Charles I in England. But they've certainly been very common in the United States for a very, very long time.
Absolutely. Again, we're talking with Dave Koppel, Research Director at the Independence Institute. And you know, Dave, obviously gun control advocates, I saw you were quoted in the Guardian. Lois Beckett had a piece talking about what this means. And the gun control groups, obviously, unsettled, to put it mildly, right? They're very, yeah, very concerned about this. Now, you noted that this doesn't guarantee that the Supreme Court is going to start hearing Second Amendment cases again, because we really don't know for sure why we haven't heard the Supreme Court, or why we haven't seen the Supreme Court take a case since McDonald. But it certainly raises the likelihood that the Supreme Court is going to hear Second Amendment cases going forward. And for gun control advocates, you know, they haven't pushed this issue. They've not pushed gun control cases up to the Supreme Court. When the Seventh Circuit ruled that the ban on carrying firearms in Illinois was unconstitutional, they acquiesced. They said, we're not going to take this case to the Supreme Court. And they begged Rahm Emanuel, go ahead and, you know, go along with a shall issue concealed carry bill. When Washington, D.C.'s good cause requirement for concealed carry licenses was struck down by the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, they went to D.C. and said, can you please take one for the team? Don't take this to the Supreme Court. Clearly, the gun control groups are worried about the Supreme Court hearing a case as it stands. And now, again, with this improving the odds that you're going to have those four justices that are willing to hear a case and maybe five to decide in favor of the plaintiffs who would be challenging these gun control laws. Are gun control activists right to freak out right now?
I think they're right to be concerned. There were five justices in Heller. Of those, in the subsequent years, three of them, Scalia, Alito, and Thomas, at one time or another wrote a dissent from denial of certiorari, saying the Supreme Court should have taken this case. So those are the three that have said we should be doing more on this and treating it like every other right. Justice Gorsuch, succeeding Justice Scalia, also did the same thing in his first term on the court. But that leaves Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy, who never issued any dissent from the certiorari denials. And so I think the anti-gun groups correctly recognized that these are the two variable guys, and we don't know where they're going to stand. So maybe we don't want to push them. Just like in the cases you said, like, well, does the Second Amendment right to bear arms actually mean, like, is that the same as the Second Amendment right to keep arms, which it's a right that normal law-abiding American citizens have and can't be restricted to just, you know, less than 1% of the population, which is given a permit. So they didn't want to test that. You know, the answer was nobody really does know, I think, what this new court would do. Justice Kavanaugh would presumably make it easier to get the four votes you need to grant certiorari.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, getting to those four for certiorari doesn't do you much good unless you've got a fair chance of getting the guy number five to vote in your favor when the case comes up on the merits.
Absolutely.
We're still up in the air about where Chief Justice Roberts is, and we just don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair reading. And, you know, again, it speaks to the importance not only of, you know, the Justice Gorsuch pick replacing Antonin Scalia and this pick, but, you know, again, the possibility of more retirements coming over the next, let's say, 2 to 6 years,
right.
Dave. Right.
That's absolutely right. And remember, Justice Thomas is no spring chicken. And I'm not sure his workout routine is as rigorous as Justice Ginsburg's. You know, what if in let's say there's a Democratic president in 4 years and Justice Thomas leaves the court during that president's term, maybe for health reasons, and that, say, President Elizabeth Warren or President Kamala Harris gets an appointment, you would then have a five-justice majority that would be the most left-wing Supreme Court we've had since the days of President Lyndon Johnson.
That's right. That's right. I mean, again, there's a lot at stake. Can't take anything for granted right now. If you are a gun owner, we've got to get involved, remain involved. And in the meantime, Dave, I really appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Thank you so much for your insight today.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for what you always do, which is you set a nice tone. It's a great way for people to talk about the gun issue in a way with a lot of passion in it, but not rancor and hostility.
Well, I thank you for that. Thank you again, sir. Dave Koppel joined us, Research Director at the Independence Institute here on Cam & Company. Hey, listen, I said last night, I mean, I have some degree of empathy for those folks who are flipping out right now, who think that The Handmaid's Tale is just around the corner. Because I know what my reaction would be if we were looking at a fifth or sixth judge that was going to be an anti-gun vote sitting on the court for decades to come. I might be flipping out a little bit, too. I might have lefties mocking me on Twitter, Cameron, based on my tweets. It could happen.
Listen, a couple weeks ago, The Handmaid's Tale, which, as we know, is one of my favorite shows. I'm a closet fan. The main character, Offred, or June, as she was known before, the takeover, she used a shotgun for self-defense. I was really surprised. She was hiding from the couple that owns her, and she had a shotgun, and she used it when she had to go outside of the garage because there was a wolf there. And she had to make a decision. She had the couple were there to get her because she was hiding, and she had the gun pointed at them. They didn't know, of course. And she was struggling to shoot, but she didn't shoot her captors, I guess. But she used it for armed self-defense, and lots of scenes with her carrying the gun properly, too.
That's amazing. Well, I'm sure there'll be I don't want to give any spoilers, but I'm sure at some point she'll get her comeuppance from those in charge there in the world of The Handmaid's Tale. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout when we come back. Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Stick around. Much more Cam & Company still to come.
Speaking with Dirk Grove from NRA Store, I'm always excited to talk about, Dirk, what's new at NRA Store? What do you got for us today?
We've got a couple exciting items. One of the most important things that I wanted to talk about was, as you all know, there are some folks out there that have changed their cooler brands lately, and we have a really nice cooler from Orca. It's a 20-quart cooler. It's roto-molded with 2 inches of insulation, so it's supposed to keep ice cold for 10 days, which is kind of amazing to me.
Yeah.
It's 20 quarts, so it's a manageable size. And it's a nice black, and it has a nice gold, huge NRA on the top of the cooler.
I heard a little something about that cooler thing. So it's great to see NRA stepping up and bringing a product like this forward. It's a beautiful looking cooler, and it's perfect timing because, you know, it's getting to be that outdoor weather time out there, Dirk, all across the country. So that's awesome.
Exactly.
Yes.
And folks that are going to carry those coolers to the beach will want to wear our new T-shirt.
Ah, good segue, it Dirk, says, by the way. Very good.
It says everything you need to say. It says, and I am the NRA. And it's red, white, and blue. And it comes in men's and ladies' sizes. So we're not going to leave anyone out. And it's must wear for the summer.
Awesome. Now, Dirk, I need to ask you a point of personal preference. When they're men's sizes, they're good men's sizes. Like a guy of my size, I'm so frustrated when I get a shirt, I wear a 2X, and it doesn't fit me very well. I imagine these are good roomy shirts.
They're good and roomy, but, you know, we do offer 3X if you would like
there
to
you go.
Avail yourself of that as well.
I'll take that in, Dirk. I'd rather the shirt be too big than too small. So that's awesome. The I Am the NRA shirt, perfect for the for summertime wearing.
And so, you know, we know that if you're going to be wearing that shirt, you might be supporting us politically, but there's a really good chance that you're also going to be a shooter. And so because of that, we have some things specifically for shooters.
Good.
One of the things we have is our new updated cleaning mats.
Ooh.
Our cleaning mats, we started out with cleaning mats a few years ago, and we sold just a boatload of them. We only offered AR-15 and 1911. Now, we've updated these with all new diagrams, and they are heavily researched diagrams, so I'm very confident in the accuracy. But we offer AR-15. We offer 1911, we offer Glock Generation 4, and we offer a Remington 870. And by the way, the 870 is long enough to actually place your 870 on it while you're cleaning it.
Awesome.
They're solvent proof, moisture proof. They'll keep your kitchen table nice and clean while you're cleaning your firearms.
Perfect. Speaking with Dirk Grove from NRA Store, what else you got, Dirk?
I got one more thing today. We've been working with the makers of Sport Ear. They make hearing protection. They've got some earbuds. They call them the Axel Ghost Strike. What's really cool about these things is they amplify sounds up to 6 times, but any time they detect a noise that's higher than 85 decibels, then they automatically suppress and protect your ears.
Wow, that's cool. It's so great, Dirk. There's so much good high technology, and it's so important to protect your hearing when you're a shooter. So it's good to see the NRA store once again stepping up with a product like this for folks who are out there shooting. That's good stuff.
Well, we know our audience.
You think you figured it out by now, huh, Dirk Grove?
I think so, yeah. And by the way, the audience can always find us at – they can get a new catalog if they like, but it's 1-800-877-6007 or NRAstore.com.
There you go. How easy. I always look forward to getting my catalog in the mail, Dirk Grove. Love it. Love it when you're on the program. We appreciate it. NRA Store, check out all these great new products and all the other stuff from NRA Store. Thank you, Dirk Grove.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to Cam & Company. Cam Edwards, your host here on NRA TV. So earlier today, we had the opportunity to sit down and talk with Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation about the pick, Brett Kavanaugh, to the Supreme Court. Take a look and a listen. Larry, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program today.
It's a pleasure to spend time with you, Cam, as always.
I saw that the NSSF put out a statement last night after President Trump made it official he was nominating Brett Kavanaugh to fill the seat left vacant by the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy. And NSSF very supportive of this pick, and you say that that the organization is going to do what it can to see that there's a confirmation vote?
Yeah, absolutely. We're really very pleased with the selection of the nomination of Justice Kavanaugh, or Judge Kavanaugh, soon to be Associate Justice Kavanaugh. And we will be communicating our support for the nominee to the Senate, and we're calling for a swift confirmation. We want to see him on the court by the first Monday in October when the next Supreme Court term begins. We think he's an excellent choice. He is very much a mainstream conservative justice. And as I'm sure you're aware, he wrote a very important dissent in the Heller 2 case, where he held his dissent that the District of Columbia's ban on modern sporting rifles, in his view, was a violation of the Second Amendment because those semi-automatic rifles are commonly owned and protected in the Second Amendment based on the Heller dissent. So we're very supportive of this candidate, and we hope to see him on the court by first Monday in October.
Talking again with Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. And, you know, you talk about the Heller 2 decision, the dissent that just Judge Kavanaugh authored up. And I was reading last night both the majority opinion that ended up upholding D.C. semi-auto ban as well as the registration requirements, and then reading the dissent by Judge Kavanaugh. And I got to tell you, you know, Larry, we've seen several Supreme Court justices have written dissents of their own when the court hasn't taken a case, and they've said, we've got to step in. The lower courts are really ignoring what we said in Heller. They're treating the Second Amendment like it was a second-class right. If you read Judge Kavanaugh's dissent in the Heller 2 case, look, he's not making it up as he goes along. He's not saying, well, I'm a gun lover, so of course I'm going to strike down these gun laws. He even says at one point, look, as a resident of the District of Columbia, I may actually be in favor of some of these requirements, or I might not be opposed to them, but the law doesn't allow them to stand. The Constitution doesn't allow the District of Columbia to go and ban these commonly owned firearms that are owned by millions of Americans for a variety of law-abiding purposes. It just doesn't allow it.
And what's important about Judge Kavanaugh, as he has said in the past, and as President Trump mentioned last night, he views his job as a judge, correctly so, to read the text of the statute, to read the Constitution as written and apply it as it was intended at the time it was written, and not to inject his own personal views into his decisions or to legislate the bench or to write policy. That's the role of the legislature, not the courts. So he's very much in the vein of Justice Scalia and some of the other conservative justices on the court. This is a very important pick because it does shift the balance in the court to a more conservative majority. And we hope that we will now see going forward, the court will start to take Second Amendment cases to, you know, flesh out what was left undecided by the Heller decision, to resolve the conflict in the circuit, for example. As you know, some circuit courts of appeals say the Second Amendment doesn't even apply at all to modern sporting rifles, which is, to us, very surprising considering there are now 17 million of them in civilian possession in the United States, more common than a Ford F-150. And I'm sure if you walked out of your building, walked out of the street today, it would take you about 5 minutes to see an F-150 driving down the street, right? Very, very popular. So that's got to get resolved. What is the correct standard for reviewing Second Amendment challenges as a fundamental order of liberty, as was decided by Court of McDonald? Does it deserve to be treated same as other fundamental liberties with strict scrutiny, or do you have this sort of interest-bearing analysis been going on in the courts of appeal, which is not the holding of Heller, which is really Justice Breyer's dissent in Heller. That seems to have been adopted by the courts of appeal. That's simply not the holding of Heller. I mean, Second Amendment is very clear. You know, the right shall not be infringed. And so to have an infringement on a fundamental civil liberty, you really need to have a highly compelling reason for the government to infringe upon that right. And it's not just sort of weighing the interest of public safety versus the interest of the individual. Because in that analysis, as we've seen, almost every time the government wins. That's, as Justice Scalia said in Heller, the Second Amendment takes that choice away from the government. It's the right of the people to decide what firearms they want to have.
You know, absolutely, Larry. In fact, I want to quote to you, this is John Feinblatt, president of Everytown for Gun Safety, who said that Kavanaugh is someone whose judicial record demonstrates a dangerous view of the Second Amendment that elevates gun rights above public safety. We oppose this nomination and urge the Senate to vote it down. First of all, I think that that is a gross misreading of Judge Kavanaugh's dissent in Heller 2, but I would expect nothing less from Everytown for Gun Safety. Actually, you know, if you go and you read the dissent again, Kavanaugh talks about how, look, there would be plenty of longstanding gun control laws that would not run afoul of Heller. Scalia talked about those prohibitions against felons owning firearms, for example. But the test that he used was the view that talked about the text, the history, and the tradition of the Second Amendment in this country. And what he found is that these bans on commonly owned firearms are not commonplace in American history, that they do fly in the face of the Second Amendment, that they don't just apply a regulation to the right to keep and bear arms, but that they infringe on those rights. So I know that the anti-gun folks are going to try to portray Brett Kavanaugh as some lunatic who wants to, you know, put an AR-15 into the hand of every toddler on their first day of school. The fact of the matter is, you know, this was a well-reasoned decision. It doesn't mean that Judge Kavanaugh is going to, you know, knee-jerkly and reflexively support every Second Amendment case that comes along. But what we know with this Heller 2 case that he did take a look at is that he read the Heller decision, he read McDonald, he studied what the court had to say in those cases, and he came to the conclusion that under the precedent set by those two cases, that this ban on commonly owned firearms in Washington, D.C., and this requirement to register every single firearm that every gun owner possessed in Washington, D.C., that both of those ran afoul of the Constitution. And frankly, you know, Larry, it's really interesting that we're not hearing any real substantive attacks from these gun control groups about Brett Kavanaugh. Instead, again, they're having to make stuff up like he doesn't care about public safety.
Right. I mean, it's what the left does all the time. They have these personal attacks. They can't attack the argument, so they have to attack the person. And I think the American public will see right through that. And I'm confident that Judge Kavanaugh will be confirmed by the Senate, and that he will be on the Supreme Court come the first Monday in October. And I think it's for America that we have a judge who's not going to try to, you know, be the philosopher king sitting on high, imposing his will or his policy choices on the American public. He's going to apply the Constitution as written by the founding fathers and apply the laws written by the legislature, whether it's Congress or states, and leave the policy decisions to the legislature. But the left, as we've seen over many decades, they use the courts to advance policy because they can't convince the American public to support their position. So, and we're very, very pleased by what we see in the writings of Judge Kavanaugh in general, in his his approach to the law and his jurisprudence. And of course, obviously, we're very critical. We see in the Heller 2 dissent, where it's very clear he respects the decision in Heller and rejected the interest analysis of Justice Breyer, which unfortunately seems to be adopted by many of the circuit courts.
Talking again with Larry Keenan of the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Larry, I think we're having a little bit of technical issues here, but we will wrap it up. Thank you again very much for your time this afternoon, and I look forward to talking again very, very soon, sir.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation with us here on Cam and Company. Only have a few minutes left here on this edition, but we are already hard at work for the Wednesday Cam and Company. We'll give you a sneak peek. Rhonda Ezell from Chicago Guns Matter. She was at the Chicago March for Our Lives over the week, or March for Our Rights over the weekend. Also, Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty. Sean Maloney of the Buckeye Firearms Association going to join us on the program as well. On tomorrow's program. Plus, we'll have all of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. In the few minutes that we have left here in this edition of Cam and Company, let's get to one more think piece on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. This is from romper.com. I'm not sure I know Romper, Cameron. You know Romper, the website? Have you spent much time there?
No. Sounds. I'm sure it's going to be great, though.
Josie Rhodes Cook, Brett Kavanaugh's views on gun control are extremely problematic. yes. If he is confirmed to the Senate by the Senate to serve as a new justice on the Supreme Court, Romper writes, Kavanaugh would likely move the court in a more conservative direction for years to come, and in gun violence prevention policy specifically. Let's call it gun control, Romper. That's what it is. Kavanaugh has made it clear where he stands. He seems to be a strong supporter of broad gun rights under the Second Amendment, according to the LA Times. The outlet specifically noted that in 2011, Kavanaugh filed a 52-page dissent when the appeals court upheld a District of Columbia ordinance prohibiting semi-automatic rifles and magazines holding more than 10 rounds by a 2-to-1 vote. Indeed. And according to the LA Times, he wrote, as one who was born here, grew up in this community in the late 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and has lived and worked in this area almost all of his life, I'm acutely aware of the gun, drug, and gang violence that has plagued all of us. But our task is to apply the Constitution and the precedents of the Supreme Court, regardless of whether the result is one that we agree with as a matter of first principles or policy. See, that's key. And it's something that so many lower courts around the country have ignored in the wake of the Heller decision, where you've had judges go out of their way to misread or simply ignore what the Supreme Court has said in Heller, which is one of the reasons why you have seen these written dissents from sitting justices saying, hey, we've got to hear these cases because these lower courts are absolutely abusing what it is that we said. They're going off in all these new directions, and we've got to rein in these lower courts. Now, Brett Kavanaugh, in his dissent in the Heller 2 decision, he actually, again, he looked at what the justices said in Heller and McDonald, not so that he could try to write an opinion that would comport to his worldview, so that he could actually look at what the Supreme Court has said in terms of the law and in terms of these gun control ordinances there in the District of Columbia. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Cam and Company. That music means we've got to scoot. We will see you tomorrow live, 2 p.m. Eastern, right here on NRA TV. I'll be on Dana Lash tonight as well, 6 p.m. Eastern. We'll see you there as well.